there, and welcome to episode 200 of Radio Free Nintendo. That's right, 200. This is essentially our four-year anniversary of being on the web, and we are so happy to bring to you today the classic, awesome crew of John Lindemann.
Quality never goes out of style.
James Jones.
Hey.
And Greg Lee.
Ahoy, hoy, everyone.
I am your host, Jonathan Metz, and I am actually recording from the dirty, dirty South here in Birmingham, Alabama, and I'm using a little bit of a different recording setup, so if my voice sounds different, that's why. Hopefully it won't distract you too much as we get going on with the goings-on. So we have, I think, a modest plan for episode 200, which is kind of the way I wanted it to be. I actually, kind of going back a ways, had this vision for 200 where we kind of just did a regular episode, but had a nice feature topic. I mean, I really like when we do those because we're all kind of talking about the same thing. And so instead of talking about a particular game, I mean, we don't do that a whole lot anymore because Retroactive kind of fills in that niche. So if talking about a game, we're going to do Nintendo DS. I mean, it makes sense, right? The 3DS is around the corner, and DS has now been out for 6 years. So it's getting up there in terms of age.
It's an old man.
Yeah, I think it's obvious to everyone that the DS is sort of fizzling out slowly and fairly gracefully, certainly much more than some other Nintendo systems have. but it seemed like a decent time to kind of recall the arc of the DS and talk about how it got started and how it slowly carved its way into our hearts. And I believe actually today's new business will bear that out and we'll give you a pretty clear idea of just how relevant the DS still is. So that's the plan for this episode. We're going to kick off with new business like we always do. So my big new business game this week, I played a few things, but the main thing I've spent by far the most time on this week is Puzzle Quest 2 on the DS. You know, I had read some reviews of it that seemed pretty positive, and a lot of them seemed to indicate that the Xbox version was kind of the superior one. It's on Live Arcade for like $15 because it's half the price, and you get voice acting, and it has online multiplayer, which the DS is only local, which I still think is crazy. I don't know why they can't do online multiplayer in freaking Puzzle Quest.
Well, it's a timing thing. I mean, let's be serious here.
Yeah, you know, I was a huge fan of the original Puzzle Quest. I'm on the box for the PC version. I probably played the first one on DS for 100 hours. And
do
that's...
you use that pickup line in bars, Johnny?
I'm the box hunter. You think it's James, but... Yeah, but, you know, I love the first Puzzle Quest, and I thought the concept was great. The execution was mostly great. The main problem with the first one is that the DS version was terrible. I mean, it ran like shit. It was all screwed up, had visual and audio bugs all over the place. The touch interface was, let's say, eccentric, at least. And it was just kind of a mess. I mean, it had frame rate problems. Puzzle Quest on the DS had frame rate problems.
Did D3 publish that game?
Yeah.
Well, there's your problem.
Well, they published this one too. They didn't make it. It's made by Infinite Interactive. So the good news is, and you know, I had a pretty good idea that this would be the case when we saw it at PAX East, but the good news is DS version Puzzle Quest 2 runs great. It really runs the way it's supposed to. It looks much better. They've done a lot to the UI to kind of make the puzzle pieces bigger, to make things easier to find. It's all just better organized. It's easier to get to the things you want. The gameplay itself hasn't changed that much. It's certainly far, far, far less crazy than Galactrix. I mean, it carries over a couple of ideas from Galactrix in terms of some of the mini games feel a little bit similar. And in some respect, there is more exploration, but I think there's actually even more and better exploration in Puzzle Quest 2 than there was in Galactrix. But it does feel like they've kind of gotten back to the gameplay that they understand and that they do the best, whereas Galactrix was really overreaching and totally got out of their hands, you could tell. This feels polished, it feels very well thought out, it feels a lot like the first Puzzle Quest, just with more stuff to do, a few new ideas that work really well. And it's just as addictive. I mean, I did radio trivia with 2IP the other night, and I told him that Puzzle Quest 2 is like the methadone for my heroin Picross 3D addiction. I mean, I'm just kind of moving from one drug to the next, you know. But Puzzle Quest 2 is really good. I mean, if you like the first one, it's a no-brainer. I'm sure the Xbox version's fine, but for me, the portability of Puzzle Quest is a huge draw, not because I'm going to play it in the car or something like that, but it's almost, I mean, almost a perfect example of, and then Picross 3D is a bit like this too, but Puzzle Quest 2 is not even timed. It's almost the perfect example of a game that is great to play while you're watching a movie or a TV show or listening to music. Because you can take all the time you want to make your moves. It's mostly a visual experience anyway. The music in the game's nothing to be missed. And it requires a lot of thought, but it after a while, it becomes a little bit automatic. You know, the thought processes that you have to go through. And so you can kind of pay attention to something else on the side. So, highly recommended. I'm going to be playing it for a long time. I'm sure this will be the last time I talk about it, but I'm going to get a good value out of it. So, John, you're up next.
Yeah, in honor of our DS feature for episode 200, I decided to download a game from DSiWare that I follow on Twitter. I follow Dylan Cuthbert from Q Games, and he's been kind of hyping, even though a lot of his tweets are in Japanese, so I can't read them. But the only thing I can read is, is Xscape, and then a whole bunch of kanji. But
in Japan, it's called X Returns. I think actually it just came out there.
Yeah. So I've been kind of curious, you know, in these tweets that I am unable to read. I've been kind of like, because the thing is, I follow Q Games because they typically release a lot of cool stuff. You know, what I like is they kind of boil like a simple gameplay concept down to its simplest elements and kind of just make something cool out of it. So I'm always kind of following what they're doing. And Xscape is a DSiWare game, and it's kind of like a cross between Battlezone, if any of you remember Battlezone. If you're
Hell yes. Yeah. What, do you mean the original arcade one or the PC game from the 90s?
The original arcade one.
Okay. Yes.
It's kind of like a cross between Battlezone and, what was the Star Fox DS game?
Command.
Which they made. Yeah.
Yeah. So you're a tank that is, you know, moving through 3D space, and it's all 3D, but it's very simple polygons. It kind of has that vector graphics feel to it. And it's good. The problem with it, though, is the controls. You use the touch screen to move your tank. The problem is that there's no target to really let you know how far you should push forward, because you bring your stylus up to make your tank go forward, back to make it go backwards, and, you know, to turn it left or right, it's obviously left and right. The problem is it's really hard to gauge how fast you're going to go, because there's no target. The touchscreen is actually more of a HUD. And so a lot of times what you'll find is if you're trying to chase something, because one of the early missions is you're chasing this car around and it's holding some crystal or something like that you have to get back and take it back to some communication beacon or something like that. And so you have to chase this car down. And so, you know, while it's driving away from you, you have to shoot it while you're chasing it. And the problem is I always found myself overshooting it, because it's really hard to gauge how far you should put the stylus up on the touchscreen to actually go the speed that you want to go at. That's kind of my, you know, first impression, is that, you know, I'm going to see how it goes. Maybe, you know, maybe I'll learn the controls a little bit better. But right now it just seems like the controls are kind of unwieldy. Now, the way the game works is that you're dropped into these battlefields and you have a certain objective, like you have to shoot a certain number of targets in a certain amount of time or whatever, and you have your mission objectives, and then you get a score at the end of it, and there's these little Star Fox kind of touches to it, like the game starts off with it's actually a sequel to a game I think that came out in 1991.
Yeah, it's just X on the Game Boy, which is why it's called X Returns in Japan.
Yep, and so the story setup is that you are coming back to the planet that you saved. And of course, the general that you were, you know, fighting for at the time in the original game, he's now a bad guy. And so he's the emperor and he's done all this bad stuff. But right off the bat, you're thrown into this kind of faux boss battle with this gigantic emperor head with, you know, these kind of things circling around it. So it reminds me a lot of, you know, the Star Fox.
Andross.
Yeah, it reminds me a lot of Andross. And so you kind of see stuff like that where, you know, there's nods to these, to, you know, Star Fox and games of that type. Now, one of the cool things that they add to it is the fact that you're not just on the ground. There's ramps where you can actually jump off of them. You can get your speed up and jump off of them and you can fly. and then you can drop down when you feel like it. But still, the controls are kind of weird. I mean, you know, they have little things like you can go through rings, very Star Fox-like, where you can go through rings for extra points while you're flying in the air.
Is there any kind of on-rail stuff? I assume the normal stuff is, you know, kind of an all-range kind of mode. Really.
Yeah.
So they're more sort of explicitly Star Foxy bits otherwise.
From what I've seen so far, there is some on-rail stuff in the form of these warp tunnels that you go through. Where right. you have to, I mean, well, for example, one of the tutorials that they put you through have you going through this warp tunnel where there's doors that open to the left of you and to the right of you, and you have to dodge them, and you have to, you know, shoot yeah. enemies that are up above you and on the sides of the tunnel.
It's very much like tunnel sequences in Star Fox, then.
Yep.
In the original Star Fox, yeah.
Yeah, the original.
John, is this Xscape, is this like black and white, or am I just thinking that because of the reference to Battlezone?
It's very much like that. It's all solid colors on a black background, so everything will be orange or everything will be red. Simple but stylized graphically.
I mean, do you like it? Do you think it works?
Yeah, it works. I mean, it definitely they're kind of going for a retro feel with it, and I think it works for this type of game because it's more about kind of being a throwback game for what it's nothing that I didn't expect from it. Let me put it that way.
Cool. I mean, how many people thought John Lindemann would come on here and talk about a DSiWare game?
Yeah, I thought I'd, you know,
seldom.
throw you a curveball there.
I was interested to hear, I was reading an interview with Dylan Cuthbert, I think it was Gama Sutra, but don't hold me to that, where he was talking about what Q Games are doing, and he was basically saying that they've got kind of a half and half split on their team between the pixel junk stuff mm-hmm. and things that they're doing for Nintendo platforms, so it seems like this is going to be a kind of ongoing kind of stream of content that they're going to be delivering for presumably digital download services on Nintendo platforms. Maybe they'll collaborate again on a retail product as well.
I actually wish they'd do something on WiiWare.
Yeah.
Since I don't have a DSi.
I guess they just like the tiny constraints that the DSiWare puts on them.
Yeah, they seem pretty comfortable kind of in that arena. Like, that seems to be almost their forte now.
I mean, you can't fuck yourself over too much on a DSiWare game.
Yeah.
I mean, even if it goes badly, how much could you really have spent on it?
True, but I mean, on the other hand, they do these 1080p artwork intensive games for PS3. So
this is insurance.
Yeah, but I mean, even those are very stylized graphically. You know, all that pixel junk stuff. Well, maybe not all of it. I haven't played enough of the pixel junk games to really say that. But
they are stylized, but not in a simple way. I mean, if you look at especially pixel junk shooter, very complex artwork.
She was like, we just go for this look. It's like the most gorgeous Flash game look ever or something. Right, it's really strange kind of look.
So that's Xscape. And Greg has Jam with the Band. And by the way, Greg, this is a really interesting game. You know, it came out years ago in Japan. And now it just came out in Europe for some unknown reason. It's never been out in America. Probably never will be.
Quite appropriate, I think, probably for this episode, considering that although this is based on a sort of second version that came out in Japan during 2008, the original Daigaso Band Brothers that this is born out of was a launch game for the DS in Japan.
Was it really? Jeez.
Yeah, at the end of 2004. It's not often that I, in research for purchasing a game that came out a month ago, read a review from 6 years ago, which I did in the case of TYP's import review of the original Band Brothers.
Oh, and he loves it too.
Yeah, he gave it a 9 all the way back in the, it's 2004.
It's funny you mentioned this game this week and not, say, like, next week, because Carly bundled up a bunch of these and has sent them to people who asked for them.
Yeah, yeah, apparently it was going extremely cheap.
It was going for like £8.
I had already bought it, what I considered to be extremely cheap, a couple of weeks ago.
She maxed out the number of copies you could buy.
Ooh. It really seems as if they put it was a very unexpected announcement, considering, you know, it was kind of a couple of years after it came out in Japan, it was completely out of the blue, and then they have not put any appreciable marketing behind it that I could see, and it doesn't seem like it's really made any impact.
So there's hope for Excitetruck.
I mean, Excitebots is dead.
Excitebots, I mean.
Yeah, because it's pretty much an Excitebot situation, really. Quite unusual. So I do remember from the time reading about the Daigaso Band Brothers, it was really quite acclaimed, and wondering when it might come over, and then of course it didn't, and then we had the second conversion, and then seemingly that didn't come over, and then here it is. I think so. One of the things behind it is obviously the licensing situation, and they recently quite helpfully put out the sort of Iwata Asks translation for this a month after the game came out, and they actually in it they kind of talk about obviously how the licensing was handled in Japan, but then in annotations they have to mention how the licensing was handled here. And what it is, it seems like they made a deal with EMI to have licensed songs in there along, you know, quite a lot of public domain and Nintendo stuff. But there's a difference in how things were handled compared to the Japanese version, because in Japan there were about 30 songs on the card, and then you could download 100 songs. But the catch was, once you download one, you can't delete that ever. Because it basically, you've got to have several hundred, or I think in the case of Europe, I think it goes over 1,000.
It's like 1,800, yes.
Yeah, songs that you can download, but the way the licensing agreement was struck was that the people would never be able to just download all of those over a period of time by, you know, trying one, deleting it, and then downloading another one. So once you download something, that's it. That's irrevocable.
There is real peril in downloading them.
Yeah, that's how they negotiate a lesser fee, essentially, you know, to contain the licensing costs on these things.
That sounds a bit like Pandora, how you can't rewind or you can't select, you know, specific songs. You can only skip a certain number of songs per hour.
There are 1,627 songs to download, and I believe you can have, was it 15 on a cart? 20?
So here, rather than 100 in Japan that you could download, you've got 50 songs on the cart already, so it's some slightly more there. But then you've got only 50 that you can download. So it's a bit lesser than it was in Japan. But one of the things that I think is curious about that is that in amongst that 50 that you could download, more public domain and especially more Nintendo stuff is lumped into that as well. And it doesn't seem to me to be necessary to have that put into that limit, because that's the stuff that you're not paying for, well, that Nintendo's not paying for. So I don't see why those downloads should be limited. There's certainly a lot of sort of interesting Nintendo stuff available to download if you're into that, because I think it generally works somewhat better, because the way Jam with the Band works, it's very sort of keyboardy.
It's all MIDI based, right?
Yeah, it's all MIDI. Yeah. And because what you've got is just this pretty, you know, vast array of kind of different instruments and all this kind of thing that's in there that you could only really achieve through MIDI, especially on DS. And so what you're actually doing in each time you play a song is you're playing just one instrument's part in the song. And in fact, if you just go to the kind of free play part, you can pick any of the instruments that's in that particular song that you like, which is kind of weird, because of course what that will mean in certain occasions is that, you know, you'll be playing the song and it'll be quite sustained periods. We might not have to do very much, but then it'll go crazy or something, you know. So it's a bit more like playing an instrument from the point of view that it's not like just set up in a very game-like fashion where it's like concentrating on keeping the player constantly engaged. And I think where that really comes into the fore is the multiplayer mode, which is where the whole Jam with the Band kind of project started. I mean, reading this Iwata Ask was quite interesting, because kind of covered the whole history of how it was in development back on the Game Boy. And I mean Game Boy as in not GBA. It was actually pre-GBA that the development of this goes back to. And I think the original idea was that people would have different cartridges that would be different instruments.
Oh my God.
Wow.
And then they would sort of, you know, jam together to create
a
band.
How is this not a terrible idea?
Yeah, funnily enough, that didn't launch.
This reminds me of the, there was a Flaming Lips album that I think was like 4 discs, and the idea was that you'd get people with 4 different boomboxes to play their individual discs at the same time. And it would create like this symphony that would have to, right, like in a physical location that would require people to get together.
So like they had this idea of having everyone with individual Game Boys, and there would be like some special like speaker accessory that would play all the music together. And then that didn't happen. And then it was like, oh, the GBA's got better sound capability, so maybe we could do this. But apparently they struggled with making it work with like the link cable stuff. And then when you get to DS, the way it works is obviously just use the wireless capabilities, the local wireless. And what you could do is you can, or everyone can, you know, join in with the song and take a different instrument, up to 8 people, with just one copy of the game. So that really is the best thing. It's very accessible to get a multiplayer session going in that way.
Yeah, we did this once at E3 with TYP because, you know, he had the import copy and he was a really big fan of it. And we're sitting around a hotel room and we got 5 or 6 people together playing some song, but he didn't really explain how to play the game before. And I was really confused by the controls. I was like, you know, you're tapping D-pad and face buttons and shoulder buttons, and it didn't make a whole lot of sense to me.
Well, I mean, the way it's handled in this game anyway, I mean, I see there's probably some differences between the two, but the way it's handled in this game is you kind of graduate up from a very simple beginning where you were literally just pressing any button in rhythm, pretty much, to using the four face buttons and one button on the D-pad, to using all the buttons on the D-pad and the face buttons. And then the final pro sort of level, or master or whatever it would be, is that you then are modulating like the octaves with the shoulder buttons. So that's where it gets really difficult. I mean, I was playing the format that I was playing was like, you get to play these like sort of gigs, and you know, if you do okay, you get like an encore and you keep going, and if you sort of keep doing really well, your performance rank keeps getting elevated. And so mine got elevated to the point, this is, all right, you're ready to try the master mode now. And then I tried it, and you know, it was so difficult by comparison. My rank immediately went down too. It was just this huge leap up that was really difficult. But you know, that element of the game is kind of, you know, really optional, because everything is just unlocked. You can just play pretty much anything you want, apart from like, I unlocked a credit song at one point. It's just like a little bonus for reaching a certain level. So you just play whatever you want. You can go into multiplayer, obviously, you know, play songs that you download. And the way that they've kind of got around the whole like original idea of having that speaker accessory for the Game Boy is the Wii Channel. So you know, you get a ticket in the manual for the game, which is a bit like, you know, the Wii Speak Channel ticket or whatever. You put in the code on the Wii Shop Channel, download it, and then through that, the sound of the songs being played on the DS will come through the TV. But where that really comes into its own, of course, is where you've got multiple DSs playing, because obviously the sound coming out of the DS speakers isn't going to be very good.
Especially if you have different DSs too, because I know my XL will dwarf the hell out of my...
Yeah, it's like 3 times as loud as the other one.
And the other thing is that if it's all being mixed through the TV, through the WiiWare channel, or through the Wii channel, it's actually coming out like mixed and normalized. Whereas if you've all got it on DSs, they could all be set to different volume levels or in different positions around the room.
Exactly. And also, I mean, I would always play this kind of game with headphones, but if you were all wearing headphones, it kind of spoils the communal kind of aspect.
Right.
Of it, you know, it's meant to be sort of a bit of fun. I think that would really spoil it. So the Wii Channel's kind of like this really bizarre culmination of this like decade-long technical journey that they went on. And it's, you know, it's quite a clever idea. I mean, just experimenting with it a little bit, there does seem to be a slight bit of a lag between, you know, your inputs and hearing it on there, maybe. I don't know, this is exactly a rigorous kind of test, but I could still see the purpose of it. And I think that's probably where this game kind of shines the most, is just that it's a really kind of, you know, of all the ways to play a music game these days. And of course, since the original came out in Japan, the music genre has changed so much. I mean, it's amazing. But the one thing about this is, as although it might seem a bit sort of old-fashioned, it is just very accessible. You could give it to, you know, anyone, doesn't even have to have a copy of the game, just have a DS, and they can play, you know, on parity with you. Like I said, it kind of more mimics, I think this is something that TYP mentioned as well, it kind of does more mimic playing a musical instrument rather than playing a game. So it's a cool little game. It's got all these different levels to it. You know, it's kind of Yeah, it's a solid rhythm action game in its own way, and certainly I think the fact that it doesn't have some bizarre control scheme makes it more portable. I mean, this is a music game I will happily play on the train versus like Rhythm Heaven or Elite Beat Agents, which I wouldn't. I mean, anyone within close proximity enough to hear me trying to do lockstep on Rhythm Heaven
would probably be driven. I don't want to hear about it. I want to hear it.
Would probably be driven insane by that.
They'll just hear tap, 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 tap.
But yeah, so this is, you know, genuinely sort of portable, you know, music game and all that. And then it's got these kind of musical toy elements to it because you could do so much. You've got quite a robust suite of creation tools to make your own songs, which you can submit to be uploaded to the internet, and you can, you know, share them with your friends through the local wireless. You've got this weird radio function where you can actually log on to the Nintendo Wi-Fi connection and hear the sort of download chart. And as you hear the songs, you can actually then just click a button on the touchscreen to download that song straight away. If you
does
like
it have
it.
A synthesized Casey Kasem?
No, it does have that bizarre character from Barbara the Bat. It's probably the weirdest thing that Nintendo has ever produced. And very oddly, just in the radio part, is voiced by a very proper sounding British lady.
Perfect.
Very wrong. Yeah, but so yeah, it's really impressive feature set to go along with it. So, I mean, it's a shame that this is being kind of, even to the, you know, where it's being released here, it's being kind of, you know, certainly nothing approaching the kind of push that was put out for Rhythm Heaven, which is very much more gamey, to use that term, you know, coming from the WarioWare boys and everything.
It's funny because I feel like the appeal of that game might actually be more substantial than Rhythm Heaven, which is a game of rage.
Yeah, well, exactly. It's Rhythm Heaven is so... Yeah, I mean, for instance, with this, you can't fail out.
And in Rhythm Heaven, you can't not fail out.
Well, yeah, you will fail out the first couple of times, pretty much guaranteed. That's the way the game is. I mean, with this, you know, I even drew my catastrophe playing on the top class mode, you know, my score was pitiful. It didn't fail me out. And you know, you will hear the sort of... Because of the way the MIDI system works, you will sort of hear the how wrong you're being. Which is quite blood-curdling. I assume that's where the multiplayer jam sessions could take on a sort of car crash comedy element of just how bad you sound.
Okie doke. Well, that's Jam with the Band finally out in Europe. And James is going to wrap up new business with yet another 4-in-a-row DS games.
Yeah,
is it an RPG, though? Oh!
First off, no.
Damn.
So I completed the Mega Man Zero collection, which doesn't seem like it's that big of an accomplishment, but...
Oh, no, that it is.
I did not beat all the games on hard. I beat 4 on hard. I started 3 on hard and realized, wait a minute, I have played this game before. Even though I didn't remember playing 3, and I dug through my my box of games, and I'm like, holy shit, there's Mega Man 3. I dropped it in the GBA. I'm like, holy shit, I beat it too. Well, then F this, I'm playing this crap in easy mode. I don't need this. So I burned through... Well, I got through most of 1 in hard mode, and I was like, fuck this. This is awful.
Yeah.
Now, when you say hard, do you just mean not easy? Is it called hard? Or
It is hard, but it's a normal.
Yeah, it's not some extra selectable difficulty setting that you decided.
Okay,
to put.
See, James, I thought you were, like, intentionally going above normal and saying, you know what, Mega Man Zero on normal, way too easy for James Jones.
That's what I was trying to clear up.
No, there is no hard mode. I mean, the game itself is hard. See, yeah. The problem with the first game is that it starts you out with a bunch of lives, but if you run out, that's it. If you continue, you get one life. It doesn't reset your life stock. It's like, okay, here's one life. Don't die one time.
Yeah, the first one's so brutal. I mean, by the fourth game in the Zero series, they've fixed so many little problems like that. It's so much more playable.
It's funny because the game, so in easy mode, it literally is back to back to back to back, and I can burn through a game in about 2 hours. It's so easy. I just don't die.
Huh.
But it's fun because you can see how the game evolved because you might play an entire game in one night because it's only 2 hours long.
Mm-hmm.
but it takes away a lot of the fun of the game because it's just too easy.
Yeah, I mean, I've always thought that with these sorts of games, if you didn't have the challenge of learning the level layouts or the enemy patterns or whatever, then the game just loses its substance.
Yeah, that's classic old school gaming because all the games were so short.
Right. I mean, it took me God knows how many hours to beat Mega Man 0-1, a lot, and I beat it on easy mode in 2.5 hours. And that's basically just the amount of time it takes for them to go through their really poorly written exposition. Which in the first two games is really poorly written. Staggeringly bad.
I heard they fixed typos in the collection, but apparently there was no comprehensive relocalization.
There are like phrases that just don't have verbs in them. Yeah. They just don't.
Yeah.
Like my personal favorite was they're trying to make this really emotional scene between Zero and the female character. And her dialogue to him when he's getting ready to go on a mission is, Zero, safe.
Words to live by.
Yes.
Let me write that down.
There's supposed to be B in there, right? I think. And the funny thing about how the game evolves is the first two games are pretty much the same. And they follow the Mega Man X model of, here's four enemies, here's the boss, the end. Or actually, it's here's four enemies, here's like a middle boss, and here's four enemies, and then here's the end game. Whereas in some of the later games, they kind of do weird stuff with it, where it's like, here's a few enemies, here's a mini boss, here's some other stuff. And then the last game is just different. It's much closer to what the DS game became. But it's kind of amazing to think these games were only 1 year apart each time. Mm. But when you play them all the way through, you realize, holy crap, they reused every asset they possibly could to make these fucking games. Like, the soundtrack is almost identical in 1 and 2.
Yeah.
In 3, they turned it into this techno crazy garbage. And then in 4, it's back to the soundtrack from 2. It's so weird. Like, I enjoyed playing through those games kind of like as a reminder.
Mm.
But it does really show how, like, playing 1 on hard again, I don't understand how I beat that game. I don't understand why I beat that game, because I feel like I should have just been like, no, this isn't fun anymore, and just dropped it.
The levels are just death traps. I mean, they're so cheaply designed.
Well, see, basically, spikes are instant death unless you find upgrades to make them not instant death anymore. But even then, they do a ton of damage. And if you play easy mode, you get all the upgrades to start with, which really nerfs everything. So basically, you can just stand there and hit bosses and kill them because they'll run out of health before you will.
Rubbish.
On regular mode, aka evil pain hard, like spikes are instant death. There is a stage where basically you have to climb these elevators that are broken, so they only go halfway up, and then you have to jump to another moving elevator. And everything else is spikes. So if you touch anything for like a minute and a half, except for these tiny little platforms, you die.
Yeah, the Zero level designs are so brutal. And the enemies, in the first couple games, the enemies took a lot of hits to kill.
Yes.
They never drop energy. A lot of that stuff was tweaked and fixed by 3 and 4.
What's weird about the Zero games versus, well, I guess other Mega Man games do this to an extent, but it actually tells one singular story across all four games, and that story makes no fucking sense, which is, I respect right, the effort, but the fact that there is a city that is continually beset by the same freaking problems over and over again makes me believe that somebody should probably do something besides, oh, whatever the fuck they've done for the last three games.
They need to elect Tagger as Maya.
He would take it out. He'd just start spinning.
The Zero series story is also predicated on kind of understanding the Mega Man X story,
yeah, which
didn't make any sense either. So if you skip the X games and go straight to Zero, from the very beginning they're talking about Reploids and Mavericks and stuff.
Yeah,
and they're gonna have no idea what's going on.
It's heavily leveraged on whatever happened at the end of the X series that they never finished, basically. So apparently at the end of the Mega Man X games, everybody died. But no Mega Man X game has covered this history of where everyone dies.
It's Chrono Cross.
Yeah, it is a little bit like Chrono
Greg,
Cross.
Greg, sometime you will have to explain to me the meaning of Chrono Cross's story.
I only know what Shane Bennhausen and Jeremy Parrish
It makes
told
no
me.
Fucking sense to me.
Yeah, Chrono Trigger. Awesome. Chrono right. Cross, even better.
So, yeah, let's get back on topic. So after Mega Man Zero Collection, James, you had a litany of other games that you
yes.
could talk about. What have you decided on?
It's not my way to play games, you know, play multiple games at the same time, because it's I tend to just fixate on a game
to
and
devour.
Yes, and devour is a good word for it. Yes.
Unicron-like.
We had mentioned that I had Mirror's Edge, but I hadn't really put much time into it. I'm actually going to – I've got a blog post I'm working on because it's not Nintendo-related. It must be a blog on the success and failings of that game, which I think it does have some very noteworthy successes and some very noteworthy failings.
Yes.
It's the kind of game where the idea was really awesome, but I'm not sure how you make that game. And they did the best with what they could, but it has problems because of it.
Yeah. They just have to put it in Kinect so you run in place and
oh, yeah, you would die.
jump around and kick off the walls.
We watched some people play the Sonic Riders Kinect game, and it has like a 10-minute racetrack, and the person looked like they were about to die any second. I started Sin and Punishment, but I haven't really got a lot of time into it, and I can't do it justice since Craig's spoken of it.
I see everyone's got their copies. Yeah.
I plan to soon, but I did notice, you know, I don't have cable at home, but since I'm traveling, I've saw a little bit of TV, and Nintendo of America has a really nice commercial for Sin and Punishment.
Really? I haven't seen it.
I overheard it, and I ran over to the TV to watch it, and it's very well done. It makes the game look awesome.
I'll have to go try to find it.
I'm glad that they're actually trying to market that game.
And that leads me to one of the many careers I've had in the past on top of video and audio production, website design.
Voice acting, musician.
Voice work.
Gigolo.
Classical music groupie.
Chimney sweeper.
Busker.
One-man band.
Was El Presidente of Banana Republic.
Oh my God.
I decided to go relive those years during the Steam sale that is going on right now. But if you're listening to this episode right now, it is still going on. If you got it the day the episode came out.
Run right now.
Yes, go. Stop listening. But I got Tropico 3 for basically nothing, like $9 or something like that. Because I've always heard that franchise is kind of funny. But basically, you are the dictator, or president, depending on what you want to call yourself, of an island nation in the Caribbean, and you have to somehow build the economy while repressing any kind of dissent.
Is it like SimCity?
It is a lot like SimCity, actually, except you have a secret police force.
Nice.
So the first few tutorials are pretty straightforward. Like, one of them is you're on an island, and there's no mineral wealth at all, and basically you're going to go into debt just to keep up your buildings if you don't make money. So the only thing you can do is turn your beaches into the private retreat for Americans on vacation, which is great because you make a lot of money and all the capitalists in your society think this is awesome. But all the socialists and all the religious people who disapprove of the behavior of these tourists and all the poor people and the militants who don't like outsiders don't like it.
All those party poopers, in other words.
Yeah, so you basically have to use your military to crack down on any kind of dissent, because I cannot tolerate this.
That's my kind of country right there. Good job, James.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it's so much like, it sounds always exactly like Canada.
Hey, shut
all
up.
All those beautiful beach resorts and the mounted secret place.
Bears, beavers, secret police. That's what it is.
Oh, my God. So, like, I was enjoying... So, we had an instant where somebody tried to get me to bribe them to let them run our economy into the ground, and they were going to transfer money into my Swiss bank account. So, I had them killed. Because this is how I run my society. It is a game for sociopaths. It totally is. Because you can be the worst bastard in the world or the nicest guy on Earth, and the game doesn't care. It's like, are you managing your economy well enough, and are you not going to get run out of office? It's actually like a SimCity where you can lose, basically, and not lose because you built your residential places next to your power plant. You do have to, you know, do a lot of economic management, because if you don't have money, you get in trouble. You know, you can't finance anything. You can't build anymore. Your foreign relations go into crapper because you're running your economy into the shit and they're having to bail you out. You have to kind of manage your relationship between the Soviet Union and the Americans. You can't go too far on one side or the other because you risk being invaded by the faction who wants to control the island. So it's kind of, there's a lot of little things you have to keep track of, but the game itself is pretty relaxed and you can do other stuff while you're playing it, or you can play it in fast mode to get the money going. I actually kind of enjoy it. I mean, it's not a great game, but it does have its own humor. The entire story, like events that are going on in the game, whereas in SimCity, it's like a little pop-up saying, there's a tornado. This has these radio broadcasts that are so clearly government-sponsored radio. It's like, today is El Presidente's weather. El Presidente told the sun to come out, so it did. There will be no rains today. There was one, like, when the Russians were blockading up one of my ports, it was, the Russian bear has decided that it's not happy with us anymore. They should be wary lest they ruin El Presidente's siesta, and he drives them away with his big stick. It's like, what the fuck?
James, does playing Tropico 3 inspire you to go back and actually finish the review of that SimCity game for Wii?
Oh, God, no. it pretty much proves everything that was wrong with that game. That game is too boring. It's too whitewashed, basically.
Narcolepsy-inducing.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
If games like that can't just be click to put a building here, there needs to be some kind of element beyond that to it to make the game fun. Because there's millions of games now where you build cities. This game, at least, there's kind of a little bit of grit to it because you do have popular dissent that you can choose to have killed or blackmailed or imprisoned in secret prisons and run out of a food store. I mean, it has enough comedy that the game itself is funny while you're playing it, which is enough reason to keep moving.
All right, then. That's going to be the close of New Business for this week, episode 200. A DS game from each of us. It's a sign of things to come. When we come back from the break, we're going to talk about the entire history of Nintendo DS.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
All right, this week's big news is our site redesign. Be sure to check out the new look of the site and let us know what you think. We aren't done yet, as we'll be adding more community features over the months to come, and we'll fix everything.
Don't tell them they can't see it's broken!
A big feature we had go live over the past week was the E3 2010 Awards. Proudly present our E3 Awards known as the Megatons.
Damn right they're known as the Megatons.
Yep. We offer our verdicts on the best Wii and DS games at the show, as well as the best 3DS demos and the best 3DS videos. Hit talk back and tell us your favorites.
The Deal Machine feature returns. This time we get great prices on notable titles like Mad World, so check it out.
Gaming for sociopaths is this month's theme, apparently. So, enjoy. And then, finally, we have Neil's impressions of The Blob 2, The Underground, which is a look at the DS version of THQ's upcoming title, straight from E3 2010.
I should read that. The Wii version was totally depressing looking.
As in, like, it was looked like it was going to be bad, or it was just depressing?
No, I think they actually showed the original The Blob and just stuck a number 2 up on the logo. So that's everything for Now Playing this week. Check it all out on the brand new, totally redesigned, sparkling clean NintendoWorldReport.com. Alright, we are back for segment 2 of RFN 200. It's all about the DS, and as usual, when we do these big feature topics, Greg has done most of the work up front, and he's going to guide us through his prepared notes.
So, we will begin now our journey back in time, looking at the remarkable life cycle of DS. Obviously, it's sort of appropriate with the torch being passed now to 3DS. There's a few different periods we're going to focus on here. Obviously, the most contemporary DS-related stuff, going back to sort of the DSi and all that, we're not really going to concentrate on because it's far too current. But the first phase of the DS's life that I wanted to talk about is actually the year before it came out. This begins at the end of 2003, so this is after the poorly received connectivity-driven E3 of that year with Pac-Man Versus and all that, and Satoru Iwata's ascension to NCL president, as we've sort of discussed quite recently, helpfully enough. But at the end of that year, they had actually posted the first and, as we've discovered, since only financial losses in the company's history. So it's really quite dark days for Nintendo.
Which is why they sacked that Iwata guy, right?
Well, he pretty much inherited that, I guess. They were already well on that path at the time.
You could say the DS was his stimulus package. It's like, check out my third pillar.
Oh, God.
You should have called it the third leg.
Thank you, John.
Well, it ended up being a lot bigger than the first two, right?
It certainly has. They announced the fact that the following year, they would release new hardware that was not a successor to either of the current platforms that they were operating at the time, being GBA and GameCube. So this was a pretty bizarre sort of announcement in many ways, not necessarily anticipated, of course, considering both machines were relatively new at the time. And we didn't know much about it initially. It first had the code name DS. We obviously sort of surmised it was going to be a dual screen thing, and then it later had a new code name, which was Nitro, and then kind of just went back to DS for E3.
Yeah, and Nitro was the development unit name, so Nitro was not as temporary as you just made it sound, Greg. I mean,
they kept using that internally for quite a while.
Right, the same as GameCube and Dolphin. I mean, it was called Project Dolphin at one point before it came out.
But if Dolphin felt like that was in the public arena for years, whereas the Nitro was in the public arena for sort of months, basically.
Right, it is still around if you look at the
SKUs,
unit number.
Right? Yeah,
the SKU number. Yeah.
There'll be N at the end, yes.
But this announcement was certainly quite strange at the time. It was, again, not dissimilar to the 3DS. This was, not a big announcement, a summit or anything like that at the time. It was initially just an announcement that they would be launching new hardware. And, of course, all this was going on in the Spectre of PSP, which we knew was in development at this point.
Yeah.
And that really is probably the most sort of interesting part of the story, is just how different things were at the time. Obviously, GBA was doing well. I think it sold to this point about 20 some odd million units, which was sort of outpacing the PS2, which is quite impressive. Given the PS2 obviously came out of the gate pretty strong despite its appalling launch lineup in Japan. Nevertheless, the entry of Sony into the portable market was very radically different from any of the previous companies that had attempted to get in on Nintendo's turf, as it were. So this is kind of the landscape that we're dealing with when they first announce it. And first of all, I wanted to talk about how the people here reacted to this announcement.
I don't remember the original announcement of this in detail, but I know it became apparent pretty quickly that it was going to have two screens.
Yeah.
The original description of this thing from Nintendo kind of mentioned that just as an example, this is like the kind of thing you'd see in a patent application, was that you might be able to have a soccer game where you see the entire field on one screen and a close-up view of an individual player with handling the ball on the other screen. And I'm not sure if such a game was ever made, actually. But, at the time, I was thinking, two screens? I think everyone's first reaction was two screens. It seemed like so superfluous. I mean, so extravagant.
It seemed really gimmicky.
What would you need two screens for? Yeah, exactly. Because at the time, we didn't know about the touchscreen until E3. There were some rumors before that from developer leaks, but they didn't actually announce the touchscreen until E3. And so before that, everybody was like, why would you want two screens on it? There were some bizarre ideas about what this thing would look like.
Lots of amusing mock-ups, I remember.
That happens even when it's a conventional system.
Yeah, and then I think once E3 came around and they showed it to us and they explained the touch screen and we actually got to try it, the whole thing made a lot more sense.
Well, that was, of course, that was the thing. So it was, again, similar to 3DS, you had this sort of fairly nondescript announcement with then E3 to kind of blow it all out, although there was a lot more mystery surrounding this in terms of what exactly it was going to be. So E3 was really a huge sort of importance in terms of being a launching pad for this mysterious new platform. And actually, my preparation for this, I went back and watched the entire E3 2004 media briefing, which of course a lot of people at the time will remember for being Reggie's debut and the Twilight Princess reveal at the end.
Yes, the first Twilight Princess versus the third.
Yeah, the first Twilight Princess, back when it wasn't called that.
And Reggie also pulled the GB Micro out of his pocket.
That was the year after.
Oh, really? In 2005?
Oh, yeah. That's right,
we'll
because
get
the Micro
that.
The Micro came out at the very, very, very end of the GBA.
I always get E3s mixed up. Sorry.
2004, there was a lot. It was kind of trippy. You see Reggie and George Harrison together. That was, you know, it seems like when worlds collide now. So the two eras of Nintendo kind of passing in the night, as it were. So obviously everyone found Reggie's debut amusing and all this stuff. They talked, you know, they had plenty of games to talk about. Certainly a lot to talk about GBA, including the exciting debut of GBA Video with episode of SpongeBob.
Yeah. Did they really feature that in the press conference?
They did. You know, so they're talking up the GBA a lot, and they're talking up the fact that their price cut generated a lot of uptick in GameCube sales and whatnot. But the DS was the big thing at the end of the press conference, and you know, there was a lot of quite pronounced reactions as they started reading off the features because people didn't really know what this was going to be exactly. And obviously, yeah, the touchscreen, the microphone,
Wi-Fi was a huge ooh-ah moment in the crowd.
Online capacity was all got very strong reactions. The first thing that you see, the first bit of demo footage that they showed, was Mario 64. The Mario and one of the other characters just flying around the castle, basically, was to kind of demonstrate the graphics. So this was quite an unusual kind of reveal. Normally, we're kind of teased about Nintendo systems for years and years, and then we finally see them, whereas this was not just a blowout on all the actual features that the hardware had, but then comes the bombshell: it's launching this year in America first. I'm just wondering how, obviously, Johnny, you were there, you know, how you took that in the crowd and what that meant for what the system was going to be.
I never felt like I really understood what DS was about until later that E3, when we went to the booth area that they had set up. And it was similar to what 3DS did this year, where it was a separate part of their booth. You had to wait in line. You know, as press, it was easier for us to get over there. But they had all these demos in there that you could play. They didn't have 120 of them, but they, you know, there were quite a few. And they had a big four-player Metroid Hunters thing set up.
Awesome.
That was the highlight for me out of all the demos that they had.
Well, that's the thing. You see, James, you know, snickers about Metroid all the time. Other than Twilight Princess, by far the biggest reaction of the crowd at that conference is Metroid Prime Hunters.
Yeah,
people went nuts.
They could get to react to it for like 6 more years before that game finally came out.
it was less than 2, for the record.
But if you didn't just go through the back of the DS thing like we did the first time we did, I just kind of went up to the back and said, hey, I need to get in here, I'm media, whatever. But later on, we went through the normal way. And when you went in the front, you were greeted by Charles Martinet in person. Actually, they had screens up. And when you first went in, you know, this was like the waiting area. So you were queued up like for a roller coaster. And you were in this kind of sectioned off room, and it was dark. And there was a screen up there, and Charles Martinet was doing his Mario and Wario thing. And they would talk to people in the crowd a little bit. And then when it got close to time to actually go in and play the demos, Charles would come out in person and would kind of introduce a video. And the video that they showed, I thought, was hilarious, because it goes back to the videos they show now of people playing the games, playing Wii especially, but also of DS, where, you know, it was like the first video I saw in that style, where you see people and they're smiling and they're playing their DS. It's basically a B-roll kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. But they made it sound like the DS would be so revolutionary, and all these people were like picto-chatting with each other.
Oh, no.
You know, playing games communally. They're all doing their touchscreens. And the people they were showing playing it were like moms and dads and grandmas and groups of kids at school. And I thought it was the silliest fucking thing I'd ever seen, because people didn't play Game Boy that way.
Yeah.
No.
You wouldn't play a Game Boy in a group of 4 or 5 people sitting around laughing about something. You'd never see an older person play a Game Boy or anything like that.
Yeah, and I mean, at the time, too, I mean,
there's no way this is going to ever happen.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought Nintendo was ridiculous for trying to market it that way.
And at the time, Sony was on top. And I mean, gaming was very much like a teenage guy's sort of college age sort of thing to do, right? I mean, that's just the way it had evolved. So there was no casual gaming. Everybody was a hardcore gamer pretty much. And
well, there was casual gaming, though, but it was defined differently. It was people who bought Madden every year, and that was the extent of what they bought.
Yeah, you're right.
Well, I mean, that's one of the more interesting things, obviously, James. I know you, obviously, a big portable games guy going back. I mean, what did you think about the idea that given we waited so long for revisions or Game Boy hardware, and then you took the big leap with Game Boy Advance finally, that you were going to have a handheld that was, you know, I mean, obviously it wasn't on par with what the PSP was going to be, but it was still a very radical improvement in terms of the technical capacity that it had over the GBA, and B, that they were going to just sidestep that huge legacy of the Game Boy brand. I mean, what did that mean to you in terms
of... At first, you have to say they weren't trying to sidestep that brand officially. I mean, their official policy was still, this is a third pillar. But it was immediately apparent they were full of shit, and this was not a third pillar. This was a replacement device that they basically were giving themselves a parachute on.
It was weird, though, that they wanted to replace the GBA after 2 years on the market.
Yeah.
Apparently,
as I said, I mean, it had been doing quite well up to that point.
It was, but at the same time, I was aware of the fact that the GBA made them money when they sold units. And I just assumed, well, this is going to make them more money when they sell units. So
because they always make money on the hardware.
Right. I mean, I viewed it at least partially cynically, thinking, well, this is a way for them to make more money because there is new hardware out there. But I also accepted that they realized that the industry was moving at a speed much faster than the crawl they had moved with on the Game Boy process.
Well, I mean, we had the color in, what, 98?
Yeah, it was super late.
After the original Game Boy was 89, and then you had, like, the Pocket at some point.
Yeah, and I recognized that other competitors had come along with superior hardware, but just hadn't been able to crack that market.
Well, I mean, one way that I kind of, you know, I wouldn't say I settled on this view because I kept an open mind until I would be able to actually get a hands on the device and play, you know, the games themselves. But to me, it almost seemed like something of a vote of no confidence in the DS to say, well, this is not the next Game Boy,
right?
Primarily because if it goes down in flames, we don't want to tarnish the Game Boy brand.
At that point, they had no choice, though.
I mean, we hear all the time, and we've heard, you know, now when they talk at GDC or whatever about the fact that they've always got hardware stuff going on and they prepare devices that don't get launched.
Right.
Because in the end, they look at, you know, the market and say, nah. And it kind of felt like this was one of the cases where this perhaps was, under normal conditions, something that they wouldn't launch. But because you had this threat of Sony coming in, they felt they had to go out there with something, but it didn't carry their full confidence because they weren't willing to give it the GBA brand. And that concerned me.
I think that's close to reality, actually.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense.
That's the DS, you know, when I saw it at E3 that year in 2004, I thought it looked pretty half-baked.
It looked like a prototype.
It was a prototype.
Yeah, because it was.
They cleaned up the design a bit before launch. I mean, if you go back and look at pictures of what it looked like at E3, it was pretty bad.
It's where it's got the black band across the whole middle.
Right, and there was like a mono speaker in the hinge or something. It was really strange. So they ended up putting the speakers on the sides of the screen on the launch units.
Yeah.
But it looked like a mess of features that made no sense together and really bad system design. Like, just bad ergonomics.
Industrial design.
To be fair, though, the ergonomics of the launch DS weren't great either.
Yeah, the E3 unit was worse, but the launch unit was pretty terrible. And I think, actually, the DS Lite was kind of the... I'm sure we'll get to that later, but the DS Lite to me is the full realization of what the DS should have been when it launched. And I think maybe Nintendo had kind of originally planned to kind of keep cooking the DS concept until the technology was kind of up to where it was when the Lite was released, but maybe Sony forced their hand, or they just kind of felt jittery about the way the GBA was performing or something.
I think they also wanted to get their name out there too, because Sony had the lion's share of mind share at that time, and I don't think they wanted to lose traction because really the portable market was the only thing they had left.
I think the real threat that Sony presented, as far as obviously, yeah, you could talk about the tech, but the real problem I think that you had to fear was their potential and willingness to cross subsidize. I mean, that is what they do. So even if the PSP got off to a slow start or didn't do very well. That Sony's, you know, massive revenue generation in the other aspects of its company, especially, you know, with the PS2 doing so well at the time, you knew that they would be willing to throw money at that, you know, kind of like the way Microsoft did with the Xbox and all that, no matter how much it was losing to a certain extent, to try and get a foothold in what they would consider to be in the long term a very lucrative market. And so this is why it was so much more of a danger than anything Nintendo had faced before. You know, I mean, Atari is not going to be able to do this. Sega's not going to be able to do this.
Well, I think the other risk, though, is that pretty much every competitor they had come up against had some stupid flaw in their hardware.
But what I'm saying is, even if Sony did have a stupid flaw in their hardware, and there's lots of things wrong with the PSP. Yeah.
Well, there are, but it was certainly more...
They had the money, they had the wherewithal, and they had the willingness to actually stick with it through that kind of bad time.
I mean,
and
much like Microsoft with Xbox, they're going to make it a success at any cost.
Yeah. Right. They also had prior success going into it, too. They weren't just...
Well, they made the Walkman.
Yeah, and if there's one thing they can do is make nice hardware.
And they didn't.
Well, I think it was really weird the way, you know, Greg, you mentioned that the first DS game they showed was Super Mario 64 DS. And I thought that was a really strange choice because it was, I mean, in 2004, you know, the N64 hadn't been gone for that long. So it was kind of impressive to see an N64 game running on a handheld. But at the same time, I think it was the wrong approach, because if you look at the comparison, I mean, if they hadn't launched DS, you'd have GBA going up against PSP. And GBA, as we know, was essentially basically a portable Super Nintendo. I mean, it was more powerful in some respects, but for the most part, it's about the power level of a portable Super Nintendo. The PSP is more like PS1, PS2. And the PS2 had only been out for a few years at the time. So the PSP was like a portable version of a system that you currently play.
Right.
And to compete with that, Nintendo showed the DS playing a game from 1996.
Yeah.
I thought it was a strange, antiquated kind of demo to show and a strange launch title. And I just want to make the point that I think they are completely fucking nuts for showing off games like Star Fox 64 3D. For the 3DS, because this is a game that, other than the 3D effect, could have been a launch title for the DS in 2004, and now they're showing it as a potential launch title for the 3DS.
There are some interesting parallels there, indeed, again, surprising parallels to me. But, I mean, it was interesting watching the press conference again, because Reggie... Yes, it's probably the first time that Nintendo really started hitting this message so hard, and obviously they did many times since with the Wii. But he's talking about, diminishing returns to graphics. He's talking about this analogy about buying a car and to the left brain and the right brain, and how, you know, well, one part of you just wants to know how fast it gets up to 60 miles an hour, and the other part of you just wants to know where it can take you and all this stuff. So the one end is kind of downplaying the idea of horsepower going into the DS, but then at the same time, there was that part of the press conference which was just, oh, look, it's Mario on a handheld.
They had to show a Mario game, they just had to, but the idea, oh look,
you know, it's polygonal 3D. Remember,
right.
Remember when this was amazing? Well, now it's on a handheld. Isn't that amazing? You know,
yeah. But how is that taking you somewhere you haven't been before?
Exactly. There was some inconsistent messaging there, and I think really, what we'll kind of segue into the next sort of era of the DS, which is.
Well, could I make one comment real quick?
Sure.
One super cynical comment, and the reason that. They showed
from James?
Mario, yeah, shut up. The reason they showed Mario 64 DS might well tie into what we'd speculated, that it was kind of a late in the game decision that, okay, what piece of hardware do we have on our kit that we can build a marketing message around from our R&D team that we could launch in the next year? Because, like I said, okay, we have this game, but we don't have time to build a whole new launch experience for it. Can we port N64 to this thing?
Yeah, right. And then this is where we sort of come to the launch phase of the DS, when it comes out in America in November, and then in Japan in December, and then in Europe and Australia in the early part of 2005. But you get to the launch phase, and it's time to see, you know, how much they've really been able to prepare for this system launch. And slim pickings, to say the least. In fact, in America... There were 11 launch titles, and Super Mario 64 DS was the only first party.
There were 11 launch titles, and 6 of them were terrible.
Well, and Nintendo really tried to spin this around as a good thing. I mean, they said, look at all this great third-party support we've got, but
Ping
none
Pals.
Of those games are really that great.
Ping, well, I mean, Ping Pals is game of the year all years, John.
Yeah, Ping Pals was the worst of the bunch. That's a way forward technologies.
It was worse than Pictochat. I mean, seriously.
I mean, Feel the Magic was kind of the one launch title that everybody was kind of gravitating towards.
That's the only launch title I have from the DS, and I have a launch day DS. Think about how boring my life was with the DS for the first 6 months. I had one game and that god-awful Prime Hunters demo. Mm-hmm.
Feel the Magic, it doesn't hold up to the test of time, but I do think Sega was very smart. They kind of latched on to the zeitgeist at the time of what the DS was about and what people wanted to do with it. And as it turns out, I don't think people got that excited about Super Mario 64 because they didn't really want to play Mario 64 without a joystick. What they did want to do was play games with a touchscreen, which they'd never done before. And Feel the Magic gave them that, even if it wasn't a great game. It was something new, and it was interesting to look at, for sure.
The funny thing about that game was it had character, which none of the other DS launch games had. Mm-mm. I mean, they were all kind of generic games or just not good games, and their character.
There's some licensed stuff. Spider-Man 2 was a launch title, and
yeah.
I thought the engine is great for that, especially for a launch title. It looks good. It runs beautifully. The game design is fucked. I mean, it's just impossible.
Was that
to
the
play.
One where it replaced buttons with touchscreen taps on pictures of buttons?
There was some of that, yeah. There was some early like overusage of the touchscreen.
I mean, but that was the only game that when they showed the lineup kind of jumped out at you. And the funny thing is that game in the end probably served a good purpose that usually a WarioWare game fills in providing this is what the hardware can do.
Well, of course, not long afterwards, in the few months that followed, I think we were pretty soon in Japan, you had things like WarioWare Touched, you had Yoshi Touch and Go, a few other things, which really started to show this was Nintendo stuff that actually did seem to exploit the abilities of the DS more than something just like Mario 64.
But those were also mini games, basically.
Yeah, well, this is really where the sort of nakedness of how rushed it all was sort of came through, because I mean I think certainly a lot of people having played something like just called Balloon Trip or whatever when they were demoing it, Yoshi was like, oh well, this is just a tech demo, it's showing the uses of the touchscreen, it just happens to be sort of Yoshi's Island themed. And then of course the actual game comes out actually quite a little bit after the DS itself, and I mean I own that game. I bought it second hand, a Japanese copy for quite cheap, and I've got an immense amount of use out of it. But I mean, it's basically what we would now consider a DSiWare game.
Mm-hmm. Right, I was surprised that they released Yoshi's Touch and Go, because I had played it at E3 and I thought it was just a showcase.
No. Exactly.
It's one of those things that'll never actually come out.
It was just a classic touchscreen tech demo, and then all of a sudden it shows up.
Right, like the one where you were sawing through logs. That was a tech demo at E3 2004. You were sawing through things.
That's a good game, though. I mean, log sawing is a good game. It's underserved market.
And, things like WarioWare Touch, obviously was a bit more sort of a game, in the sense it was obviously quite similar to WarioWare that you'd already had, but with touchscreen stuff. And I don't think at this point Twisted had actually come out in America yet. I think it had come out in Japan.
Twisted came out after Touched, yes.
Yeah, in America it came out afterwards. And I think by comparison, Touched, again, didn't seem as well designed because it had been rushed out. And so you had this whole period of about 6 months following the launch where the software was really sparse, and what there was, the titles that did come out themselves, were quite insubstantial.
Oh yes, they were.
Yeah, I mean, my DS just sat there for 6 months on the shelf.
I played a lot of GBA on it.
Yeah, that's what I did. I mean,
the screen was sort of better, if you can imagine that.
I had an original GBA, so the screen was infinitely better.
Yeah, that's
my
good
devotion
point.
To original hardware iterations is unmatched.
So, well, so Johnny, obviously you got the DS in for the site, you got the the review hardware for it, so you were on board from the start. But James, you bought it on launch day, as you said. That I find that interesting. I mean, what was it that sort of tipped you to get that on launch day?
Well, because I played a lot of GBA games, and I can't even I can tell you how many DS games I have because they're all nice and lined up, but there are GBA games in pretty much every box that I've ever moved from one place to another. And if I open one up, there is a very real possibility a GBA game will pop out. And I owned a lot of GBA games. I can't even quantify the number I owned, but I played a lot of them. So I recognized immediately that this was the GBA successor.
And you could play the GBA games on it, and it was
right.
You hadn't got an SP.
No, I had a launch day white GBA. Ooh. So it not only was it old, but it had developed scratches on the screen because I just thought my backpack and take it with me.
No light.
And it had no light. It was impossible to play unless you literally were under a lamp built exactly for playing GBA games.
Yeah.
And so, to me, the jump wasn't that big. It was relatively close to the holidays, so I just sort of asked for it as a Christmas gift instead, and I just got it early.
But in terms of the sort of promise of your software down the line, you were simply of the opinion that, look, whatever they say, this is the successor. So even if they're rushing it out now, there's going to be the top-tier Nintendo software.
Well, see, the thought I had in my mind was, if this is the third pillar, they wouldn't have put GBA support in it, because otherwise, it's not the third pillar, it's the 2.5 pillar.
That was really a mixed message, wasn't it?
Yeah, again, I mean, that conference is riddled with them.
So it came down to the following decision. Do I think Sony's going to usurp them in the handheld market? And the conclusion I came to was 60-40 no. Which, if you remember how the press was treating at the time, the decision was pretty highly that Nintendo was done in the handheld market, that they were going to get buried by this.
Well, and especially when you saw the technology gap between DS
right.
and PSP.
And so, what the funny thing is, that's what actually convinced me that the handheld on the DS was probably what was going to be okay, because it was going to be so much cheaper to make DS games than PSP games. Mm. And I felt like people are going to either be downporting PS2 games to the PSP, which would mean the games probably aren't suited for handheld quick play, or they're going to spend a ton of money on these smaller games that they really can't get away with charging full retail price for, because you can't do that on the handheld.
Right. And we never really had to worry about the DS being flooded with N64 ports, because there weren't that many N64 games that were in danger of being
ported. You could have ported them all in about 2 months.
It was inevitable that DS would get a lot of original software. And also, it had all these new input methods. So
right. That
was the hope, is that it would, you know, people would make new games for it rather than port.
Well, and funny thing is, at the time, I was wondering, like, wow, what are they going to do with the microphone? And the answer is bullshit. They let you blow into it for 10 years.
Still haven't done anything with it.
It's a really amusing part of the E3 2004 press conference where Reggie's like, you will control the game with your voice and only your voice. You know, like, is the voice recognition so good that it's just going to detect it?
Yeah, right. With your breath and only your breath.
Well, so John, I mean, what about you? Obviously, what were your thoughts on it as it was coming out at the time?
Well, you know, it was weird because I saw it kind of as the ultimate experiment from Nintendo. I mean, they were kind of on the ropes at the time, and you know, they've always done really well in the portable space. But it was just something I thought, you know, I thought that it was just crazy enough that it might work. But at that time, the industry was sort of like, you know, it's just, you know, you have a console or a portable, and then a couple of years go by and you bring out something that's more powerful, and everybody loves it because it's more powerful. And it seemed like that's exactly what Sony was doing. And at the time, you really had no reason to doubt Sony, because the PS2 was such a huge success, and the PS2 just kind of, the PSP, I should say, just kind of carried that whole philosophy on of, you know, bigger, better, faster, more powerful. And at the time, you know, Sony, they had a ton of third-party support, so you really had no reason to think that the PSP would just come out and, you know, over time, flop the way it did.
So how did that factor into you thinking about purchasing a DS?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, of course, I have a lot of Nintendo loyalty, and I really just wanted, I mean, because of the kind of games that Nintendo makes, you know that they're going to do something unique and, you know, something that's probably going to be, you knew that a great game was going to come out of the Nintendo DS. So even though, you know, I did buy a PSP when it came out as well, I bought a DS just as a matter of course, because I knew that there would be some great games coming out of it. Even though it did sit on my shelf for a long time, and actually
it really did. It was my WarioWare Twisted rig, essentially.
Yeah, like I'm sitting here trying to figure out what the first game I bought for it was, and I think it might have been Kirby Canvas Curse or Meteos.
Oh, God.
Maybe
that's a long time.
It was a long time. It probably wasn't Kirby Canvas Curse, but
Kirby came out in like August of 2005, yeah. So that was almost a year after launch.
That's really the next period of the DS's life. There's a turning point after E3 of 2005, in the summer, through the holiday season, and then into the next year, 2006, where things change in a hurry. Mm-hmm.
And I remember that summer in particular because with Planet GameCube at the time, we had an advertising sort of sponsorship deal with Lixang. Might have been Play Asia. I think it was Lixang probably. But anyway, we had a deal where we could get almost any import game we wanted to sort of at will, as long as we wrote a story about it, you know, which is what I would do anyway. So yeah. I was importing all kinds of DS games that I was hearing about. So the American releases at the time were so pathetic that I wasn't interested in anything coming out. There wasn't much coming out at all.
No.
I wasn't interested in any of it. But I kept hearing on our forums, on GAF, on, you know, from friends that there were all these great Japanese games coming out. I remember the thread, I'm going to botch the title, but there was a thread on GAF that Chris Kohler started that said, Osutatake Uendan is the killer app for Nintendo DS. And then later, I think he changed it to Uendan broke my DS. But but that was the first time I heard about Uendan. And I read that, I saw the videos, I thought, wow, this looks crazy and really fun. And it's something that you could only do with a touchscreen. It only makes sense with a touchscreen. Mm-hmm. And that was the game that made me think, maybe I won't regret owning this device. And and I imported that and completely fell in love with it immediately. I thought it was one of the most fun things I'd ever done. I was like, oh my God, I'm actually enjoying playing my DS. Whereas like Super Mario 64 DS was a pretty painful experience, honestly, to go through. But you're taking one of my favorite games of all time and kind of butchering it. This control scheme with all, you know, the crazy graphics and redone music, and just, it was a port that didn't need to happen.
Well, I mean, for me, when it first came out, as I said, I wasn't convinced by the third pillar rhetoric, but I did take it to be a note of caution on Nintendo's part that this didn't necessarily have their full backing. And that caused me to not have the usual amount of faith I would have that it would have the kind of quality of software down the line. When the GBA had been doing well, there's still lots of good games coming out for it, big games like Minish Cap that came out in the beginning of 2005, and I think they'd just done like, you know, Pokemon Leaf Green and
yep.
Fire Red and Mario versus Donkey Kong and DK King of Swing. I mean, there's just loads of stuff coming out for the GBA at the end of 2004 and the beginning of 2005. And so it seemed like reverting back to that was a sort of comfy option that they could always take if they sort of tested the waters and didn't like them very much.
Right. Well, that's what my DS ended up being, though. It was my Minish Cap and my WarioWare Twisted platform. I mean, yeah. It basically was the games I played on that system until Mario Kart came out, which was, I don't know, significantly later.
It was at the end of 2005, and this really, I mean, there is a absolutely decisive turning point in that summer. We're not going to spend that much time sort of doing big lists or statistics in this, but this I feel I have to reel off. You're going from the second half of 2005. These are some of the games that came out for DS. I'm sure this is not exhaustive and it doesn't necessarily cover the import stuff, which Johnny mentioned. But Meteos, Kirby's Canvas Curse, Mario & Luigi Partners in Time, Sonic Rush, Castlevania Dawn of Sorrow, Advance Wars Dual Strike, Mario Kart DS, Nintendogs, Animal Crossing. Oh, that is, you know, compared to the previous 6 months, that is an absolute deluge.
It's a hell of a lineup.
Yeah.
Yeah, and see, for me, in the previous 6 months, I was playing some of those games as imports, like Kirby, Castlevania, Meteos. Meteos was actually probably the game that sold me on DS more than any other.
Yeah, me too.
Because I couldn't read the menus, but I could play the game no problem. And I was like, this is fucking crazy.
Yeah,
awesome.
It was truly unique.
Yeah, I mean, for me, Meteos was huge as well, because the people had, I'm pretty sure, you know, I would have read the site, the review for the Japanese version and stuff, and I pretty much got my DS right before Meteos came out in America. That was the sort of in preparation to get that, you know, the English language version. And also what had come out around that time was Kirby Canvas Curse,
yep,
which again really sold me on the idea that the
probably the best Kirby game ever released so far.
Well, I mean, it's my favorite of the ones I've played, but I haven't played very many. But I mean, this really was, you know, case like I'd always been dubious about the dual screen stuff, about, you know, how is this really gonna add something, but then when you started to see the touchscreen being used for, you know, entire games from the very basic gameplay fundamentals based around the touchscreen, that sold me on the idea that yes, you know, this device is going to bring you new experiences. But the funny thing is that once you had things like, you know, Meteos and the Kirby Canvas Curse as the hook, then there was this whole bevy of traditional games waiting behind them that you could enjoy just as much as anything you would have enjoyed on the GBA. I mean, so Advance Wars, Castlevania, I mean, these are kind of the big hitters that we saw early in the GBA's life coming back. So that really sort of reinforced my confidence in the system on both ends, that it would, you know, I mean, yes, we had the problem of like touchscreen or microphone gimmickry in certain games, like sealing the bosses in Dawn of Sorrow. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is, as much as I liked your Kirby Canvas Curse and Meteos, yeah, I didn't want it to be just that. But that 6 months proved that it wasn't going to be just that. It was going to be a very broad range of gameplay experiences.
So Mario Kart was interesting because I guess I don't like Mario Kart as much as other people. That seemed, I mean, I've always enjoyed it, but I talk to other people and I don't think I have nearly the fever of Mario Kart fever that other people do. But, and DS in particular is a game that I thought was pretty good, you know, but I've never been so totally ape shit over it like other people. But that was the first online game. It was only a year after DS came out, which is not bad, you know. And the nice thing is you didn't really need any new equipment. I mean, I think I had to go buy a USB dongle because I didn't have a wireless router yet. But basically the capability was built into the system. I think one time I actually went to McDonald's to play DS online.
Yeah, so did I. I did it just to try it out.
I did just to try it.
But it was quite a novelty, and Animal Crossing was out as well with the online stuff. I wasn't interested in that, but Mario Kart was interesting because it was really exciting to play Mario Kart online, which is kind of, I had actually done it before with Warp Pipe on Double Dash, but that was a bear. So it was nice to just, you know, have the system built in there, and yeah, you had some friend codes, but you could just go do random. And to be playing against random people online in Mario Kart was a strange experience, because that's something you can't do with Warp Pipe on Double Dash. You can't play random people. So it's like, wow, I will play this game forever. And of course I didn't. But
no.
I felt at the time like
because
maybe
you ran
I
into
could.
Fucking snakers.
There's a number of reasons that go into that. Yeah, obviously the infamous snaking, you know, sort of people just dominating and killing everyone else by using this sort of tactic that you, but I mean, yeah, whether it's cheating or not, the point is it's not fun.
There's also just not enough variety in Mario Kart for me to play it.
So for me, the biggest thing was this, because I got Mario Kart launch, you know, and I'm not necessarily the biggest Mario Kart fanatic either, but it was extremely well reviewed. You know, this was, you know, a really, really excellent Mario
it's
Kart
certainly
package.
A complete package.
Yeah,
sure.
I mean, there was none of the kind of quickie feel to this that there were to earlier DS games. This felt like the full complement of things you'd expect from a Nintendo title. And you know, the thing that really sort of soured me on online was how much better the local wireless multiplayer was, because you had all the cars, because you had all the items, you had all the tracks, and you know, you didn't have this weird thing of like in the online you couldn't even hold a shell behind you to protect you from stuff, because that would screw it up. I mean, you know, it was actually really quite limited, even, you know, leaving aside the whole issue of cheating or stuff.
Well, I mean,
whatever.
The online mode was essentially broken. I mean, it literally was not the game anymore. It was a different game entirely.
I think it probably would have been, I've heard, people on podcasts, who work in the media say, it was really fun for that first couple of weeks when only we had it, playing online. And then when everyone had it and then the snaking came in and all this, it quickly descended into pain. But as I said, it was limited. So for me, there was a novelty factor there. And then that kind of wore off relative to, if you want to experience Mario Kart, the better way is to do it with a friend.
Right. But I mean, I can remember playing player matching online with TYP because he had the review copy. So he already had it when I picked up my copy. And, I remember thinking, oh, this is going to be this magical Nintendo version of online where it just works and it's really easy to set up.
The opposite.
It was the opposite. It was a magical version of Nintendo online where it doesn't work and it's terrible to set up.
Right. I mean, because I'd played online games on the PC and I'd always felt that they were, the setup could be clunky. There was always a lot of waiting around in lobbies and stuff.
Oh, you didn't know from clunky and waiting in lobbies.
Right.
You had no idea.
And the other thing was, it was kind of frustrating that we couldn't really communicate. Mm-hmm. While we played the game.
But that was okay because it was their first shot at it, right? I kind of cut them some slack on that. I cut them some slack, I'll be honest. And I've kind of always accepted Nintendo being sort of behind the times and stuff like that. They're kind of cantankerous hardware-wise. I've always wanted Nintendo to do this, that, and the other.
You see a little bit of themselves in you, huh?
I was sad that the user experience was so clunky.
Yeah.
I thought that was the one part that Nintendo would really get right, that it'd be really smooth. I wouldn't have to look at a bunch of numbers. I wouldn't have to wait around for games to start. They just pop up.
Yeah, it's really un-Nintendo, actually, when you think about it.
I think they still haven't really found a way to do it. And there's certain inherent issues of online play that they can't fix. I mean, they're just part of the system.
Yeah,
right.
The things like ping and lobbies and player matching delays and things like that. I mean, when you get into a match and you've got two people, but you got to wait for that fourth.
That was very frustrating.
That was always, and then you lose somebody invariably because they'd get bored. And
they drop. People just turn their system off.
Yes,
and the match ends. That is really fucking annoying. And I remember thinking at the time, it kind of ruins the Nintendo polish that I would expect from this experience, because there's just a lot of stuff about online play that's very un-Nintendo.
Well, if you remember how they promoted their matchmaking system in those terrible ninja commercials where it was like, oh, I'm a level higher than you. We should not play each other.
Yeah, there is no matchmaking.
No, it is effectively, are you in the same region? Yes or no? Congratulations. Right. Here's a game.
Right.
I mean, I thought the potential's there. I thought it was relatively sort of progressive on Nintendo's part, and the potential's there for it to get quite a lot better. But I mean, obviously, it really didn't get very much better.
No, it didn't.
Or indeed, get very much more prominent across the software library as time went on.
Yeah, I mean, when was the last time any of us played a DS game online?
There was that one time where we did Space Invaders Extreme before the show.
Oh my god.
James, you had Ragnarok. Oh wait.
No. Yeah, Ragnarok offline. Yes. I've done some things that have online functionality to them, like Disgaea had some online stuff, but it wasn't an actual game.
Yeah, I downloaded a pack of puzzles in Picross.
It might be, for me, it's probably Pokemon Diamond and Pearl, which is still probably the best use of online in the DS library.
Yeah, that's probably the same for me, too.
I agree.
You could do online battles, you could do online trading, there was the trading marketplace.
And it had voice chat for online battles.
Yes, it had voice chat where you could listen to people make horrible sounds because the microphone sucked. It was good.
Yeah.
We move sort of more into the sort of the beginning part of 2006 now, which is sort of where the DS kind of cements its place. So you had this huge explosion of software leading up to the holiday season in 2005. And also in Japan, something else was going on around that time, which was Brain Training came out in 2005. And that was... This is where the promises about them actually expanding out started to come true in quite a way that you might not necessarily have expected. Certainly the hardware.
Was that before Nintendogs?
I think they actually came out really quite close together in Japan. in 2005, with one coming out in April and the other coming in May, and the Nintendogs might have been first in that. And of course, Nintendogs a huge, huge title in many ways. It's still, I believe, if you aggregate all the versions, the biggest selling title on DS.
Well, there are like 86 versions now.
Well, there are a lot, but I think they total somewhere in the region of like 23 million or something like that, which is in excess of Diamond and Pearl and some of the other ones that are really big. So Nintendogs in 2005, in all the territories, was a huge game because it obviously did reach out in a way that, you know, other games couldn't. With it, I guess it was just because it was cute and it used all the different features of the DS. You know, it made it seem like this was something you could only do on the DS.
Yeah, like which, I picked that game up and my wife saw it and she's like, "Yeah, can you get me a DS and Nintendogs so I can play that?"
Yeah, that was the girlfriend game.
It completely was.
Is it that? That's the reason my sister has that hideous DS she has.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
the bundle that came with the really hideous colors.
I think Nintendogs was one of my first experiences of playing a game and realizing that this is really good and it's not for me.
I'm not having fun, but this is really good.
I enjoyed Nintendogs for like 3 days and then felt like I had done everything there was to do and I had no interest in coming back to it ever again, and I took it right back to GameStop. But obviously, some people played it much longer. It's just, you know, for me, the cuteness alone was not reason to come back.
Well, yeah, the amount of stuff you can do is very finite.
But it kind of is something, again, that it's sort of symptomatic of a kind of new paradigm in Nintendo's design when it was trying to reach out to some of these, to different audiences. The idea of playing a game once a day for a short period, really.
So,
they obviously had these sorts of things in brain training. They've worked them into things like the original Picross DS and also
Animal Crossing had that, but it wasn't necessarily play for a small time each day. It was just play every day. And for a lot of people, that turned into play for a long time every day.
Yeah. Whereas, with Puzzle League as well, I think I had a daily play thing where it's kind of like just these little bite-sized little challenges.
It's like conditioning, though. I mean,
if it's
expanded audience, they are conditioning them to want to pick up their game every day.
Well, I think it's a shrewd move. It was a shrewd move from the point of view that they were probably concerned that, with some of these people that are experimenting with gaming on DS with these sorts of titles, that there might be a tendency that once the novelty's worn off that they would just put it down and forget completely. But if you can do whatever you can to incentivize them to spend just a little bit of time with it on a consistent basis, that they might ultimately get more drawn in. And I think, judging by the results that they've achieved, that they must have worked.
And at the same time, I mean, they're sitting there, they're changing people's perceptions of what gaming is.
Yeah,
you don't have to sit there for hours in front of a screen.
It's not like it doesn't have to be a really intensive experience of concentration and prolonged periods or truly making the experience. And it's not necessarily unique stuff like Nintendo's, but making the experience more kind of casual in a number of ways. First of all, just the ability to close up the system and put it in sleep mode and forget about it. It was so easy. I mean, you had sleep mode in GBA games with where you could hold down the shoulder buttons and press select or whatever, but the ease of just being able to close it up and say, okay, well, I'll come back to that. And the touch screen, obviously, you could kind of play certain kinds of games a lot more sort of nonchalantly than you would have done with traditional games. Even for me, the way I played my GBA was very much, oh, this is great because I love the Super NES era and I miss it. And this is kind of bringing it back, and it just happens to be on a handheld. Whereas with DS, I really felt like I was beginning to gain an appreciation for it being portable. Yeah, and obviously that became very much more of an appreciation when we actually got the DS Lite, which you could play in various conditions on the original DS. And that brings us on to the next part. So we're in the early parts of 2006, and Nintendo is making some pretty ridiculous Iraqi information minister style denials that there are any such plans for a revision to the DS.
Well, it was perfect before, so why would they make any changes? I mean, it actually left a mark in your hand, so you knew that you had played it.
They were trying to sort of tamp it down, but they did release it in Japan first, I believe, and then later on in the summer in America and Europe. And obviously there had been an acceleration in hardware sales in Japan, particularly associated with stuff like Nintendogs and Brain Age, and to perhaps to a lesser extent in the other markets. But the Lite really heralds the beginning of the DS's complete domination in the market.
It makes sense if you think about it with the kind of software that was coming out around that time, and things like Brain Age, Brain Training, and Nintendogs, and a lot of other Touch Generations type titles. The original design of the DS didn't really suit those games very well. In terms of being something that a non-gamer would want to pick up and play, because the original DS looked like a nasty-looking game system. I mean, I think back to like the original Xbox design. You remember that thing?
Yeah.
Yes.
There's no expanded audience. Yeah.
It looked like it was going to kill you in your sleep.
It did.
Yeah. It looked jiggle.
Well, I mean, the Xbox is unfair, though, because that's the people who gave us the Duke controller, too. So I mean.
Yeah. But the DS Lite looks like a makeup kit, and but not so much that, you know, a guy or even a hardcore gamer would be embarrassed to carry it around. I mean, it's shiny, it looks cool, the screens are very bright.
But as a product, it was so much better. I mean, it was light years beyond the original DS.
First modern design thing we've ever gotten from Nintendo, in terms of like something that actually looks from this century.
Yeah, but I was like, you know what? I mean, who cares about the design? I was like, this thing, just the screen is a billion times better. I mean,
yeah, because I kind of broke on the DS a bit late. When the DS Lite was coming, I was not that eager to upgrade that quickly. And I was like James, I didn't upgrade my GBA apart from having a GB player. So, you know, I was kind of stubborn. I didn't want to do it. But a friend of mine got a Lite, and I was immediately sickened by how much better it was.
You should have sent yours back. This is defective.
But it is remarkable, you know, that when you put them side by side, because having played the Lite for years now, you almost forget how bad the original one was.
So
when you put it, yeah, well, you
I know James. James is like playing it yesterday.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the different, not just in the intensity of the screen, but the color contrast and everything. I mean, you know, you sometimes felt like you were looking at a different game.
The lack of blisters on your thumbs.
Yeah, I was never a big fan of the GBA SP style, you know, clicky D-pad and the buttons and all that, you know. So I mean, there was a lot of things there that to me felt like a pretty vast improvement. You know, and so it's pretty obvious why that made a really big impact. I think, you know, in terms of reaching out to a broader audience, the aesthetic was a huge, huge improvement of eliminating a kind of barrier there. And then in terms of selling it to the repeat customers, you know, it was just, you know, the functionality was so much better. And I think that probably does go back to what you mentioned earlier, Joe, about the fact that, you know, the first version was just this sort of, in many ways, a prototype device.
Hack job, really.
Yeah.
The DS Lite was the full, complete realization of what the DS was supposed to be. And that the DS Lite is so perfect. I have one in my pocket right now, and I will never get rid of that system. Would never even think about it. You know, it's so good that Nintendo has had difficulty trumping it, even with their own revisions. I mean, the DSi, the first time I looked at DSi, I was like, whatever. Marginally better, if that, than DS Lite, and in some ways is worse. Whereas the DS Lite is superior to the original in so many ways, I couldn't even count them.
A triumph of design. I mean, I remember on the forums when I was, you know, there was a time there when I was kind of harsh on the Wii a little bit, kind of hating a little bit, you know, I'll admit it.
When is that period going to end?
So moving right along, yeah. I was always very quick to point out that, you know, I thought that the DS Lite was amazing. I mean, it was by far, I think it's by far the best design system that Nintendo has ever put out.
I think it's probably the best design gaming system ever made.
I would agree with that.
I can't think of anything that I'm more impressed by. I think it will look good and it will be popular forever.
And for what it does, for what it puts into that package. I mean, yeah, it's not pushing the, like, you know, the most the most polygons or whatever, any of that crap. But I mean, for what it does it perfectly.
It was a really big deal. And then, in fact, just a little bit before the DS Lite came out in America and Europe, it was another massive event for the DS with the launch of New Super Mario Bros. One of the best-selling games that Nintendo's released. And I don't think it's not quite. I think it's a little shy of Nintendo's, but then it is a single SKU. And it's incredible sort of landmark moment. After the success with Brain Age and Nintendo's finding the capacity to then sell some of the same people on the whole Nintendo nostalgia angle. You know, in Japan, this I think the box was actually all yellow, like the old Famicom boxes. The idea that somehow, especially just with the name, New Super Mario Brothers, that, you know, Mario had been gone for you know, 20 years when no such thing was true at all. And so this was a great moment for Nintendo. But I mean, in terms of the game itself, I had a lot of expectations going into it because it was the first original side-scrolling Mario for ages. It was something I was conceptually looking forward to happening on the GBA, but of course it didn't because all they did was re-release the old ones.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Super Mario Advance Volumes 1 through 8.
Yeah, so yeah, but it was, for me, this was overdue and really excited about it. And then it came out and I was not as happy with it as I would have liked to be, even though it is a good game. I was just wondering what everyone else sort of felt about that.
You might be surprised by this, Greg, but I was actually really happy with the DS game. And I think it's because partly, you know, I wanted a 2D Mario game so badly.
Mm.
But also I felt like in many ways it was kind of fresh for Nintendo. There were some fresh ideas in there. And I don't know how many people ever really tried the multiplayer, but I think the multiplayer is kind of subtly genius.
I tried it a little. It was fun. It was definitely fun.
I think it's shockingly fun. I wish there were a lot more levels, but.
And of course, it's the precursor to what they would do with the Wii game in many ways,
right,
isn't it?
Yeah. The DS game I was very satisfied with. I got all the blue coins or the red coins.
Star coins.
Yeah, sorry. Whatever. I got all those
coins.
And yeah, I did feel like it was very easy to blow through the game and beat the boss at the end, but I was totally compelled to get all the coins, do all the secret exits, beat the bosses as Tiny Mario, you know, which is a hell of a challenge. So I really enjoyed all that stuff. And I think the reason that I feel so differently about the Wii game is that Nintendo had kind of already done that on the DS.
Mm-hmm.
I was over the giddiness of getting a new 2D Mario game, and by the Wii version, I was like, okay, what's new?
I kind of feel like the Wii game is, in some ways, I mean, leaving aside the technical difficulties of obviously doing the simultaneous multiplayer, you know, in the full levels. I feel like the Wii game is kind of what the DS game could or should have been. In terms of, you know, there's just that bit of extra creativity, there's more hidden exits, there's more variety in the bosses. The DS game was not all the way there. The level designs are a bit more vanilla. I mean, easy is one thing, but sometimes it was easy by virtue of just not being terribly dynamic, which I think was probably my main bone to pick with it. But in general, I mean, it's still a very fun game. But it sort of signified a real turning point in Nintendo's sort of, I think, corporate strategy from the point of view that they felt now very comfortable being able to market the nostalgia stuff outside of their traditional base. You know, if you think of Nintendo as sort of an entity similar to a political party who has the sort of party faithful, they were now able to sort of send out the same messages to a constituency that lay well outside the people that, you know, followed Nintendo through the Super NES and Nintendo 64 eras. And we've seen that play out now sort of time and again, you know, not least, you know, Donkey Kong Country Returns. So it's, you know, pretty much similar sort of thing, but obviously aimed a slightly different age group, I guess.
Well, do you think that it was them becoming comfortable or them actually trying? Because I always feel like there's always been a lot of dormant fans out there that, oh yeah, I used to play that when I was, you know, whatever, 8 years old back in the 80s. I used to love those games. And they just never really mind that segment of their kind of latent
fan
base.
Well, I mean, obviously, this became a huge plank in Nintendo's rhetorical kind of flourishes about, you know, the lapsed gamer. This was their, one of their principal targets, aside from...
Yeah, I mean, I think they've always been trying to go after that crowd, but they didn't get it. I mean, they, if you think about what they did with GBA, instead of making new versions of their classic franchises, they just re-released a bunch of Famicom NES games.
Yep.
Yeah.
And they sold a lot of those, but they sold them to people who already own those systems and who would have bought the new ones as well. So, you know, I'm sure they made a huge profit. They're just basically selling ROMs. But, you know, it's a totally different story when you can make a new game with a classic character and actually get that exposed to a wide market, because then people will buy the system just to play that game. And there was a ton of that from New Super Mario Brothers. Tons and tons of that.
I mean, and that's why we've continued to see it do well in the software charts for years hence, because it's a game you buy with the system. And because the hardware sales have remained pretty good. But I guess as we move into then the sort of more mature phase of DS that goes from after that summer of 2006.
That was when our podcast started, by the way.
Yeah, that's right. That's when Evan and Mike started doing the show.
Maturity.
Moving from prehistory into history.
This is right around the time when Nintendo of America drives the stake through the heart of GBA, for a start. I mean, they completely killed
it. I thought you were going to say PSP.
Well,
no, they did that themselves.
They got a new marketing campaign. They haven't got a new hardware, but they've got a new marketing campaign.
Yeah, they've got Marcus. He's really he's really funny. I mean, I like Marcus a lot, but he's not going to sell me a PSP for $250.
No, it's
got to step me game up, Johnny.
I mean, those commercials are actually more entertaining than the system they're selling, ironically.
Well, but anything that was coming out in Japan over that past year, so like the Bit Generations, Rhythm Heaven, Mother 3, they had no interest in bringing it over. And which was quite weird because, as we kind of touched on earlier, back in E3 2005, they made a big deal of the GB Micro. You know, there was still some sort of flirtation with the idea of, you know, that existing alongside the DS. But then come a year later, they didn't want it to exist alongside it at all.
Well, I mean, if you think about if you're Nintendo in 2006, would you rather a new consumer purchase a GBA or a DS?
Oh, you definitely want them to buy the DS.
They're gonna buy a lot more games for the DS than they are if they buy a GBA, they're gonna go to GameStop and rummage through the used bin and buy a bunch of stuff for $2 with no case.
Yeah.
That doesn't do you any good.
It was interesting. I suppose some of that is perhaps because there isn't such a used game market in Japan that perhaps they were more willing to sustain the GBA there than they were in America. But whatever pretensions there were of the third pillar or anything like that were gone by this point.
This is when they were actively trying to kill the GBA and it wouldn't die.
And I mean, obviously it's a big moment in any Nintendo portable's life when you get Pokemon for the first time, really, and you had Diamond and Pearl in the early part of 2007. So that was I'm sure that added several more millions to the user base right there.
Oh yeah.
But in this phase, what was really interesting to see, I think, for me was what was going to be the balance between now, okay, we've had the early gimmicky phase. We've had the kind of the phase where we're reaching back into more traditional experiences. And now that everything's kind of settled down and it's got a big user base and Nintendo knows what the composition of it is broadly, what are going to be the games that kind of predominate? And I would say really the promise of that early period of, you know, Kirby's Canvas Curse and Meteos was not realized all that well in the end. I didn't feel like there were terribly many more experiences of that type to be had.
No, I agree. I mean, I think what happened is that a lot of developers realized that it's easier to design and produce something on the order of like a Castlevania Dawn of Sorrow than it is a Kirby Canvas Curse, because it's been done before, we know how to do it, we can do it well, and it will sell.
Yeah, the risk of failure is so much lower on this.
Yeah, and so you ended up with a lot more. I mean, New Super Mario Brothers is a great example because it's really not anything Nintendo had never done before, obviously.
Yeah.
And yet it sold gangbusters. And yeah, Nintendo made Brain Age and Nintendogs as well, and those were hugely popular. And a lot of companies tried to mimic those with
Ubisoft
with lesser success, obviously. So, I mean, how many brain training clones are there? I mean,
Sega made a bunch, Ubisoft made a bunch.
Innumerable. I mean,
Yeah, even Nintendo is ripped off Brain Age.
Yes.
I mean, they do flash focus and all that crap. So.
Oh, God.
Yeah, different trainings, yeah.
Yes. Right.
So, as it turns out, it's hard to do an original concept like that that uses the system's quirky little features. It's a lot easier to make a traditional game, and there was enough of a demand for it that why not?
If you were going to point to the best kind of touch-driven experiences, I think they'd generally be some of the not the earliest games, but just in that sort of second wave. Apart from, I suppose, Phantom Hourglass is a sort of standout of what Nintendo did in this sort of period of the DS, terms of a whole new kind of interface for an existing franchise that was, you know, completely touch driven.
Yeah, and I would argue that Phantom Hourglass isn't really improved by the touchscreen controls. It's just they work.
Yeah, they're an alternative, not really an improvement.
They're good enough, but that game would play fine with D-pad and button controls. I mean, you know, every now and then you'd pull out the stylus to take notes or whatever that they have you do, but for the most part, you don't need the touchscreen to play that game. It's just Nintendo wanted to force their, you know, philosophy on everyone. And,
well, and I think they were trying to make Zelda more approachable, weren't they?
Yeah, but for Zelda fans, they made it less approachable.
I disagree with that statement. I wouldn't say it makes the game less approachable to anybody. I mean, unless you're just adamant about not wanting to play the game with the stylus.
Well, you know, I was never adamant, but I would have preferred not to play it with a stylus. But it's not like touch controls revolutionized Zelda. Sorry, they didn't. It's not nearly like Skyward Sword. I think Skyward Sword is actually going to, you know, that game's going to feel much different because of the motion controls. And they're going to have you doing things that you've never done before in Zelda. I didn't really get that out of Phantom Hourglass.
I think the adaption it made it feel more like a handheld game than just another 16-bit Zelda game, though. I think it moved the franchise from being, well, this is kind of what the old Zeldas were like, but just, it's a different story, to being its own, like, this is what handheld Zeldas are.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. I do think, again, to go back to just the way that change in the interface makes the entire experience kind of more casual, not from the point of view of dumbing the game down, but just, you know, the way you interact with it is kind of less intense.
Well, you can play the game with one hand, essentially.
But that is quite a rare example of what Nintendo's done with their sort of part of their first party efforts on DS in the mature phase of the system, I would argue. What they've done in many ways is rely on, you know, the catalog titles to continue to sell the system. They've never felt that they needed to bring out something new just to keep hardware sales ticking over. It's more about just, you know, releasing games to sell more software. And I was wondering, has it been, you know, since it became this enormous success and established itself with this huge user base, has it been a disappointment to you how Nintendo's supported the system?
I mean, I think Nintendo's kind of done their job. I mean, it's kind of going exactly the way I thought it would go. You know, I mean, Nintendo, they brought out all their heavy hitters. It's kind of doing what the Wii did, right? I mean, Nintendo brings out a lot of heavy hitters out of the gate, and you kind of get these catalog games, and everybody buys them, and they just keep selling and selling and selling. And then kind of Nintendo sort of, you know, they turn the reins over to the third parties and they say, you know, you guys have a huge install base to sell to and, you know, go and make your best games.
And I don't want to hear you bitch about, well, we can't sell Nintendo systems against Nintendo because we ain't putting any shit out.
Yeah, especially the DS, where you have an established base of games. You can't just sit there and complain like really like you could about the Wii where, oh, you know, it's all the marketing is all casual and everybody's buying it for Wii Sports. Everybody just wants to bowl with it. You could never say that with the DS. I mean,
the DS is so versatile.
It is. There is no type of game that you cannot find on the DS. Now, it's sports titles, maybe a little weak, you know, in terms of, you know, Madden and stuff like that. But that's really the only hole that I can possibly see. And even with that, you can get stuff like Tecmo Bowl that's really cool for it.
I think the unusual thing about DS is that it's the first, it's the only Nintendo platform in a long time where we've had such robust third-party support. I mean, I own probably as many third-party titles as I do Nintendo titles on DS.
Oh, I own way more third-party titles than Nintendo titles.
Definitely couldn't say that for Wii or GameCube or N64 or GBA or Game Boy Color or Game Boy. So, you know, Super Nintendo, maybe, but probably not, but maybe. Mm-hmm. DS is such a such a revolution in third-party support for Nintendo. And I remember one day looking at my DS library, and I was adding games to it two or three at a time.
Yeah.
Sometimes I, you know, order like a bundle of shit from Amazon, and I'm really shocked when I look at it and I see how many third-party games there are, and they're third-party games that I cherish.
Yeah, they're really good.
Yeah, these are not things that I play through and then want to trade in or get rid of somehow. I mean, there's a lot of Square Enix stuff. That's part of it. There's a lot of great Japanese stuff. There's a lot of Capcom, Konami, and Square Enix stuff that is really their best output, mm-hmm. you know, maybe on any platform. But I think part of the reason for that is that there's no trade-off with DS. The only thing that it really lacks hardware feature-wise is a joystick. And you can kind of make up for that with a touchscreen in some cases, but also joystick wasn't a standard feature on handhelds until PSP. So it's not really a problem, you know, like it's not something that you would expect and then don't have. Whereas with Wii, I feel like there's a number of features that the Wii doesn't have that even at the time Wii came out were kind of expected standard things, like every controller having two joysticks on it. So there are certain experiences that you're not going to get on the Wii because the publishers and developers kind of see it as, you know, it's so special that you have to make special games for it. But with the DS, it's so versatile. It has touchscreen, but it also has buttons.
Well, it's sort of the same design philosophy that went into the N64 controller, where we had to put this 3D controller element on there. But let's make sure everything else is there in case they want to use this old style of control too.
Yeah.
Although in that case, you just ended up with the fucking trident versus a usable piece of hardware.
To be honest, in some ways, yeah, Nintendo dialed back the sort of really prominent, the real big hitters, you know, especially when you compare it to that 6 month period at the end of 2005 that we mentioned earlier. But they keep coming along with things that, you know, I really enjoy anyway. You know, I mean, it's things that I wouldn't have envisioned myself playing on before the DS come along. Stuff like Picross, for instance.
Puzzle Quest, can't imagine playing that before the DS came
out. Yeah, I mean, these are the kinds of games that I in no way purchased the system for. But when it comes down to it, you spend hours and hours and hours playing them. But in terms of the third-party situation, I mean, obviously, the Square thing is a pretty big deal because, of course, things went sour with Nintendo and Square back on the transition to the first polygonal consoles and Final Fantasy VII and all that. And then they never really had that much opportunity to get things going on the GBA because there was still that sort of animosity there.
Right, they used that middle ground, Brownie
Brown
project.
Yeah, until you had
stuff,
the whole Crystal Chronicles kind of thing, which was in, 2003?
I want to say Final Fantasy VI for GBA might have come out in 2006.
I think it was actually 2007.
Oh my God. Yeah, they were really latecomers to GBA.
That was the point I was going to make, is because you had this kind of late start for Square on GBA, they kept going with GBA way beyond anyone else did. But then once you got past that phase of them putting out all, you know, the old Final Fantasies or GBA or whatever, and they threw their full weight of the support behind DS. I mean, it really is quite remarkable what we've seen from them. I mean, the level of it, you know, obviously, yes, we've had the remakes again, and some of them have been more ambitious than others in terms of, you know, Chrono Trigger versus Final Fantasy IV. Mm-hmm. But you've had the original games, you know, stuff that, I mean, you know, a lot of people are pointed to, you know, the world.
Well, then, with you. Yes.
Yeah.
The World Ends With You being one of their absolute favourite games on the system, which is an original Square Enix title for it. And you've got all the kind of, you know, the full suite of spin-offs, you know, the Final Fantasy Tactics, the Revenant Wings, you've got
all those Dragon Quest spin-offs too.
The Joker has been huge in Japan.
Yep. The second Joker game came out quite recently.
And it made many, many people many, many expensive cars.
but you know, the Dragon Quest remakes have been very successful in Japan. I think they've done fairly well in America as well. But then Dragon Quest IX is a whole different story.
Yeah, and that really is it. I mean, Dragon Quest IX is probably the sort of crowning glory of the DS's success, especially in Japan, obviously. But, you know, because this is the mainline installment, a new mainline installment in, you know, the one of the franchises in all of gaming.
Like one of
Japan.
The top five franchises in
Japan.
Yeah,
I mean, it's you're pretty unassailable as a colossus in the industry over there. And they say, you know, we're announcing, obviously the previous one had been on PS2, and then they said, we're bringing it to DS. And that was just, you know, but that there signaled, like I said, first of all, just how much more serious Square Enix were about the DS than they were about GBA.
And it's not even just, doesn't just end there though. It, the little sub projects they picked up along the side, like the Front Mission port or Estopolis, which they have their hand in, even though they ruined it. Just random stuff that they pull out of nowhere that you don't even think about, like that Final Fantasy game they've got coming out where the entire class system is based on what hat you're wearing.
Yeah.
They've got so much shit in development now, or just out of development, that they must have a third of their company just on DS hardware.
Well, yeah, and that's not even to mention all the Taito stuff, like Space Invaders coming back and Arkanoid. And
I mean, Taito is basically like a DS developer who occasionally makes online downloadable games.
Sure, and Atlus, you know, I mean, the company like Atlus has made almost exclusively DS games for the past few years. That's 90% of their portfolio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As my collection attests.
Yeah, sure. I would also say, though, about Dragon Quest IX, that was one of the biggest announcements I've ever seen in gaming in my entire
career. It was a real huge paradigm shift.
Earth-shattering.
And I mean, part of the significance of it is that it is such a vote of confidence. It's almost like having a Dragon Quest numbered game on your platform is kind of like being crowned king.
But on a portable, though, that shows the industry moving towards portables.
This is how important Dragon Quest is. It's not so much that Dragon Quest makes platforms successful. That might have been the case for NES in Japan, for Famicom. But Dragon Quest is more a sign that your platform has come to maturity and is going to dominate. I mean, look at that series has gone from NES to Super NES to PlayStation 1 to PlayStation 2 and now to DS. Mm-hmm. I mean, that it's just, it charts the dominant platforms across gaming.
It's a sign that you've won effectively. It's like a checkered flag.
And 10 is on Wii, isn't it?
10 is
which
on
Wii. Which basically means like they can plant their flag on the entirety of the industry.
Yeah.
I'm sure everyone's already wondering with the graphical fidelity of 3DS whether it might be ported over from Wii to 3DS. Because obviously having now established itself really firmly in the portable space, because like the tag mode stuff is such a big part of Dragon Quest IX, and then that's being built into the system for 3DS. I mean, you do wonder.
Yeah, I wonder if Dragon Quest X will just not be ported, but just be reassigned to 3DS.
But because that announcement came, I think, at the end of 2006. So this is just after that rise to heaven phase of the DS, where it had taken on absolute primacy in Japan. But it also reflected, you know, the broader change in Japan, where the console sector was kind of dying a little bit. I mean, obviously, at the time that announcement had been made, the Wii hadn't really come out, or had only just come out, so you hadn't necessarily seen what that was going to do for console sales in Japan, or nor had you seen how disappointing the PS3 was going to be, but you might have predicted it from its price point. Whereas the DS had just, you know, had made all these gains, and that was a real turning point for cementing the fact that portable gaming was taking on real prominence it had not done before.
Yeah, and I don't have anything to back this up, but I'm kind of thinking out loud here. You could maybe make the case that DS had really cannibalized console gaming in Japan, and that the rise of DS and the popularity of handheld gaming, I mean, unprecedented popularity of handheld gaming in Japan, could have actually caused at least part of the downfall of the console scene in that country. Because that's where people were clearly spending their money, was on DS in 2006.
I think it's clear that obviously the DS was, to some extent, you know, just being opportunistic, you know, was capitalizing on the fact that, you know, in Japan in general, there's a lot of, you know, there's a big culture of, you know, using mobile devices and all this. So, you know, obviously, the way their mobile gaming scene is way ahead of, you know, what ours has been until recently and things like that. But yeah, I mean, I think you have to say that the DS has also played a part in shaping these events as well.
To give context to what we said just a minute ago, they announced Dragon Quest IX for the DS 10 days after the Wii came out. in Japan. That was still really early in the DS's lifespan, considering. I mean,
but obviously, as I said before, I mean, with Brain Age and Nintendo's coming out a little earlier and all that, and then of course you had the Lite early in that year. It really had, you know, in Japan, it had gone off on this absurd ascent really quite quickly, where you would have, you know, these days, for instance, to put it in context, the DS family might sell 30,000 units in a week. At this time, the was regularly selling into 120,000 units a week.
Yeah.
I mean, just absurd.
Oh, was this when we had the second wave of nobody could find a DS in Japan?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this was the period where even when the Lite was released, there was a period where retailers would offer really good deals on trading in your old fat DS, because the DS supply was so tight that they were, you know, there was actually a really good demand to buy a fat DS.
Anything
that was a DS was just, you know, it was a phenomenon, you know, reaching that kind of craze proportions. Yeah.
I remember like having very puzzled looks at pictures of people lining up in Japan to buy a pink DS.
Yeah.
And it was all guys. It was all guys. And I thought, what the hell do these guys want with a pink DS? And someone explained to me, no, they just want a DS and they don't give a shit what color it is. Yep. It's so hard to find.
Right.
I mean, it was a sort of fever that kind of all happened at once a bit more than it did, you know, in America and Europe. I think in America and Europe is more of a slow burn, which is why, you know, sales are kind of relatively higher today.
It goes back to the thing about how Reggie fought to have Nintendo DS launch in America first in 2004. And, you know, at the time, I thought it was really cool. In hindsight, I think probably the wrong decision. There was so much more potential for it. The conditions were just better in Japan.
They always have been.
Yeah. It was just the kind of system that it was, the way the economy was in Japan, and also the way that we still had a lot of GBA releases yet to come over in America. So we weren't necessarily, we didn't really need the DS yet. We didn't necessarily want it yet. Japan wanted it. They might not have known it, but they wanted it. The DS didn't do shit in America for almost a whole year.
Yeah,
well, and in Japan, it was already crazy, you know, a few months after it came out.
Well, I think they were afraid of losing the U.S. market entirely, I think, at that point, with the PSP on the horizon.
Yeah, I think that was definitely the logic, but in the end, I think perhaps more to do with the fact that the PSP just didn't get the kind of traction you might expect. I don't know that it necessarily paid off.
Right.
I'm not sure it did any long-term damage, though, because what could have possibly happened to make the Japan market better than it was?
Yeah, it seems like it's the best case scenario. But I mean, I also think that the weakness of the DS initially, it was forgotten in terms of it didn't taint the brand, you know, going forward, because you had so many kind of facelifts, and not just in the sense of the DS Lite coming along and providing the whole new form factor and kind of relaunch with new hardware, but also in the marketing. You know, I mean, the marketing went through some quite different phases from what I can remember. You know, I mean, there were some pretty bizarre commercials in Europe about, you know, just like innuendos about touching and stuff. You know,
touching is
like
good.
Which is a million miles away from what you'd have later on. But, I mean, you can't argue with how well it went in the end. I mean, obviously, now I think, was it the global sales stand at over 130 million?
Mm-hmm.
Which makes it bigger than the original Game Boy.
Which was out forever.
Yeah, which had a bigger, longer time on the market. And second only to the PS2.
DS will pass PS2 eventually.
It will. Absolutely. It will. Because obviously, yes, we're passing the torch to 3DS, all the stuff, but it's still going to sell a lot of units yet.
Yeah, I mean, think about how much price cut leverage room they have on things like DSi and DSi XL. I mean, they could, you know, they can milk that out for years.
I mean, they've started now, haven't they, with the cuts in Japan, and there's a cut gone into effect here in the UK. I assume there will be one sooner or later in America, but perhaps the relative strength of sales there are going to forestall it for a while longer. But I mean, such was the magnitude of the DS success that at one point Yamauchi was literally the wealthiest man in Japan. I think now he slid all the way down to third.
Oh no, how would he survive?
I don't know.
Profoundly heartbreaking.
Yeah.
But it is incredible. When you think of where we started the story with them posting their first financial losses ever, and obviously the Wii has plenty to do with this as well, but you know, the DS got it all going. with its approach and clearly informed what they were going to do with the Wii. So it's got the DS is largely responsible, I would say. But as we close out this feature, I wanted to focus a bit more on some of our experiences with it as time's gone on, how things have changed in the 6 years. In particular, I feel with RPGs, it's completely changed the way I look at RPGs. Being someone that didn't play them as a young person, I didn't play Dragon Warrior or NES or anything like that. They were quite foreign to me, and their sort of extensive gameplay nature, I just felt was always a bit odd on a console. It just didn't work for me. But when you put in the interface of the DS, the ability to just stop playing at any time with sleep function, and just the fact that you can so easily pour so much time into a handheld game here and there, wherever you can, whether it's a Pokemon or a Dragon Quest or a Final Fantasy, it just pretty much just opened my eyes to the whole genre. I just wouldn't be something I was interested in playing very much at all before the DS. But now I've found myself that it's viable, and I might even consider playing console ones. And I was wondering if we had any similar sorts of changes that have occurred.
I guess I have to recuse myself from this question.
Yeah, you are firmly entrenched in RPG territory, but what about, this, like I said, you have certain kinds of puzzle games, all sorts of things have flourished on DS.
Yeah, for me, I just think it's really changed the amount of portable gaming that I take part in. With the GBA and all that, I would play through games here and there, but just the sheer volume of games, Johnny talked about it, where there was a point where I was buying two or three DS games a month because there were all these games coming out that were getting like review scores of, 8.5 out of 10, 9 out of 10, 9.5 out of 10. And there would be three of those coming out a month.
And it'd be like May.
Yeah. And yeah, just
it'd
ran,
be a
like
ridiculous
random months.
Month for that to happen.
Yep. And so it really became, for a while there, it was pretty much my primary gaming platform, really. And because I just had the games to support it. So I guess I gained a new appreciation for portable gaming, really.
I agree with John completely. And I think also part of it is because as a counterpart to the Wii, DS has become a little bit of a safer haven for traditional gamers in terms of the library that's available. And so there are certain things that, in past generations I would have played on a console, but now they're either not available on Wii or they're not really as good on Wii as they could be on DS. And so I'm playing them on DS instead. So there's some of that, especially RPGs. Because if you think about GBA RPGs, people think GBA was a good system for RPGs, but most of the RPGs on that system were ports.
But still, there were a lot to play, even
kind
if they were
ports. Kind of crappy Super Nintendo
ports. If you didn't play those original games on the SNES because they cost $60 when they came out or something like that.
Yeah, and I played a few things, but when I think of like original RPGs for...
There were a few good ones.
Golden Sun, which I don't like that much. There were a couple in Japan that I never got to play, like Mother. But yeah, I think John's totally right. There are a lot of games that that I just played so much on the DS. I can't really tell you anything I played on the GBA for more than, 30 hours. Even an RPG. I can't think of anything I played that much on GBA. DS, I probably can count half a dozen games that I played for 100 hours on the DS. It's frightening. It's become so much more a part of my life, and part of that is because the system's easier to use. It has the sleep mode and everything, which I think is a really overlooked feature, but that you probably use a lot more than you even think about.
Yeah.
But I also just the quality of the games and the breadth of the library.
The breadth, definitely.
Yeah, the breadth is amazing. And one other thing I wanted to add to when I think of DS, the kinds of games that I think about is that I think it's sort of been on the forefront of this retro revival that we've had over the past couple of years, particularly in things like 2D platformers and weird retro, like literal retro revivals, things like Space Invader Extreme, which is a fantastic game. You could do it on any platform, but it makes the most sense on DS. Like it just actually kind of, when you play it on DS, it feels like, yeah, this is what I want to play on the DS.
Well, you got the paddle. If you can
import
one.
Yep. I wish I had one. But, things like Retro Gaming Challenge, I don't see that coming to any other platform. And it's not a game that uses any of the DS features particularly well.
Well, I mean, it, obviously, you know, the Retro Game Show, in some ways, as I said, I mean, it's a kind of natural piggybacking on what, you know, Nintendo did with New Super Mario Brothers, you know, like I said, selling it in that yellow Famicom case in Japan, you know, I mean, it's Retro Game Challenge is sort of following that lead. And I think what I really have been astonished by with DS is just the sheer breadth. You know, the idea that, you know, you have a system that I can play something like Picross or Nintendogs and also play Bangaio and Contra 4.
Mm-hmm.
But also just, you know, how high the quality has got on all fronts. And as I said, I mean, what platform software library would you put up against the DS in the history of games? It's pretty formidable.
Yeah, PS2 is about it. That's really, I mean, the only
it's
one.
It's nice
probably
to think of Super Nintendo as being like, you know, this awesome gaming library, but gaming was so much smaller,
narrower.
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of games on the SNES that were really good, though. I mean,
yeah, but a lot of them fall into two or three genres. You know, I mean, it's I agree with you, James. I have a very, very, very keen fondness for Super Nintendo gaming, but that library can't really compare to DS because gaming was in such a different place. It was, you know, games were made for a small audience. The developers kind of knew what you wanted, and they were
and
good
in terms
at
of how many
there
of those games you would plausibly experience, the cost obviously came into it such that, you know, even if it were more broad than it were, you wouldn't be able to buy all those games. Whereas, you know, the cheaper environment of DS today, mm-hmm. you're much more likely to be buying, you know, two a month and all this different stuff, and also much more likely to experiment. You know, I mean, are you going to say, oh, let's try, you know, at least if you know, the 10 Dogs or Picross or all this different stuff, if they were the price of console games? Well,
right,
well,
and that's always been a big turnoff for me to PSP, is that the games are $40-$50.
Yeah,
and for a portable game, it's just not right. It just, you know, turns me off.
Which, pivoting back to some of the sort of parallels with the 3DS, I think is going to be one of the most intriguing elements, is that, of course, with this greater graphical horsepower is going to be more development costs. And I wonder how far the 3DS might actually stray from the environment of the original DS, or whether there are going to, you know, whether Nintendo will be sort of quite conscious to create an environment where there isn't an expectation that every title is going to be gorgeous.
I think they've already proven that they don't care if every game is gorgeous by coming out and saying, yeah, we're going to port N64 games to this. I mean, by showing Star Fox 64, which is an early N64 game, and saying, yeah, we're going to port this. I mean, you say, okay, they don't care if some games don't look as good as others.
Yeah, but they're not going to sell that for $40. There's
no,
I mean,
but I wouldn't be
suicide.
Surprised if they sell it for $35. I mean, this is Nintendo. They would sell that game for $35 if they could get away with it.
I don't think anyone's going to pay more than $20 for that. It's a 13-year-old game.
Finishing off on the DS, a couple of quick-fire sort of questions. First one I wanted to ask was, any disappointments with things that have been underrepresented on DS, kinds of games that you really thought there were going to be that there hasn't been, over, despite how wonderful the software library is?
Not enough
MMOs.
Microphone. Not enough microphone. I want Milo and Kate. I want Milo and Kate DS.
Oh, my God. No.
In all seriousness, MMOs, like, and not necessarily like MMORPGs, but like games that actually, and I've said this before on the show, but games that actually combine the online features with the portability to do something that you can't even do on Xbox 360 or PS3 or something like that. Even though those systems are very online, they're not portable. And to me, there's an interesting design space when you cross over, when you overlap being online. And you see this in stuff like for iPhone, like Foursquare. I was shocked that we never saw anything like Foursquare on DS, because I thought that was an obvious way to go. And maybe it's just that no one could figure out how to make it into a $30 retail game. And that was the problem, was the distribution model. But I feel like there are probably, you know, what we would think of as traditional games that can be extended into using those kinds of features that we never saw. So, yeah, you know, when I heard about things like Phantasy Star Zero or whatever they did for DS, I thought the way they handled that was really poor and lacking in imagination.
I think if I had a specific like genre I was going to point to, I'm quite surprised there haven't been more like strategy games on there. I mean, we get the tactical turn-based RPGs, and that's fine. Mm. But I understand the reasoning. It's because the screen is so low resolution, it can be hard to...
Real-time strategy. Anyone remember Napoleon?
Nope.
That was for GBA, wasn't it?
Really?
I don't think it was a GBA launch title in Japan. Yeah, Nintendo made an RTS for GBA called Napoleon. And, you know, it was just stuff like that. When the DS, when they first showed it, we saw the touchscreen. Everybody said, I can't wait for all the real-time strategy games that
exactly.
are going to be on this. And, yeah, James is totally right. They never really happened.
I can think of one or two.
Yeah, the closest thing I can think of is that Final Fantasy XII Revenant Wings. I mean, there were RTS games for Game Boy Color.
Yeah, there were. I remember some of them.
Where are they on DS? I mean, even when they announced Age of Empires, they did it as a turn-based strategy game.
And you can have the top screen is your big world view, and the bottom screen is your small local view. I mean, yeah. It's almost perfectly designed, except for the fact the screen is such low resolution.
But even then, I think you can design around low resolution.
You have to work around it, but if it had high resolution screen, it would literally be the perfect system for
this. Yeah, I mean, you're not going to port StarCraft to DS, but if you make a game for DS,
yeah.
it's really odd that hasn't really happened. And somebody's going to write in with some like obscure third-party thing.
Oh, I know.
But, you know, compared to the critical mass of your JRPGs, tactical RPGs, I mean, it's not in the same universe.
No, I mean, it's such a small one that the only one I could think of, I can't even remember its name, and all I remember is that it's crap.
And yeah, and you've played Sids of Solar Empire or whatever, so you know what you're talking about.
And I have a problem.
on the flip side, there's the favorite experiences on the DS. It doesn't have to be a specific game, but the favorite sort of thing that it's brought.
Pictochat.
Oh man.
Yeah. That's something I will never forget that. I'll never.
And Pictochat, and this even goes back to the early days of DS, so like maybe E3 2005. When, you know, the first E3 where we all had our own DSs and we were carrying them around with us, and we weren't even drawing penises necessarily, but we were just...
necessarily. It happened, but nobody was being forced to draw
maybe occasionally,
a penis.
But it wasn't like a gross out thing. It was like, let's just draw pictures and they'll be funny.
They'll be tasteful penises.
They were more tasteful back in 2005. But, you know, we were doing this everywhere. We did it before the Nintendo press conference. We did it in the movie theater. We're doing it in the car. Between cars, I remember Dan Bloodworth driving his van, and I'm sitting in the back of his van, picto-chatting with someone who's sitting in Steven Rodriguez's car in front of us in traffic. And then we would lose the connection if we got spaced out, and then it would come back together again, and we'd reconnect.
Yeah, and I mean, this is all prior.
That was
like,
an amazing experience.
You know, prior to the iPhone and all that stuff, where all that stuff just became kind of commonplace, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, to be doing it with a little video game, you know, system was pretty crazy.
And now, James, I assume for you it's something to do with strategy RPGs or...
Well, kind of. It's the fact that I can walk into a GameStop, just any random GameStop, and there's like 100 of them within 5 feet of each other here. I can walk in, walk over to the DS section during lunchtime, scan around, grab 5 games off the shelf, pull out my BlackBerry, and just search on them, and one of those 5 will be a winner.
And that's how you found Miami Nights.
No, Miami Nights found me.
Yeah, it was assigned.
Yeah, the fact that you can do that. You can just go in there, grab 5 games completely by box art, and publisher and other stuff like that. Pull them out and just search, and you will find at least one winner, and you can walk out of there with a really good game for like $10. It's kind of amazing.
In terms of using the DS for something I never would have imagined, I think having it open on my counter while I cook is pretty high on the list.
Yeah, it's pretty weird.
Yeah, and that just shows you how far it's gone. I mean, how much...
I once took it to the grocery store and used it as a shopping list, just as a social experiment.
Did you get any looks?
Yeah.
I mean, you know that a console or a gaming system is ubiquitous when...
when some jackass is using it to buy his groceries.
Yeah, I mean, that's just... Well, when someone is making a piece of software that does that...
The software applications more. The language teaching software, it very much branched off into that kind of direction.
And speaking of ubiquitous, I told this story off the air. I didn't think I'd get a chance to... But I think it fits here. So a few days ago, my sister had a baby girl, and while we were in the birth suite with the baby, my little 5-year-old cousin's running around with her baby blue DSi taking photos of the baby and putting heart stamps on them. She must have taken 200 photos there. I mean, that was weird. You know, like, this is a girl. I had my own DS in my bag back in the car, you know, which I used to play Puzzle Quest on the plane. And here she's using it. She probably doesn't even own a game for the thing. Maybe she does, but I bet she uses that camera more than she plays any of the games. And that's her camera. I mean, that's how ubiquitous DS is.
I mean, I bought it for my mom. My mom is like 73. I bought her a DS.
There you go.
And she asked me for it. She said, "Can you get me one of those?"
You were like, "No."
I was like,
she wants Tomodachi collection.
I was like, "Okay."
No.
No, she wants all those. Yeah, she wants all those Japanese dating sims.
Dragon Sword.
Can you give
Ninja
me some
Gaiden
of those?
Dragon
oh,
Sword.
Oh yeah.
What's that called? Hentai? Mom, just chill.
No.
Chill.
I think it really has changed the gaming forever, which is kind of ridiculous considering that even listening to that rhetoric now, listening back to that E3 2004 press conference, it sounds overblown.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like, yeah, this is the typical horse shit everyone comes out with when they launch new hardware.
Yeah.
And then you remember, oh, it's 6 years later and they actually did that.
Yep.
Right.
Is pretty ridiculous.
You know, when you mentioned going back and watching the press conference from 2004 and all the crazy, ambitious, world-changing talk, you know, that Reggie threw out there actually came true, it just made me realize that if you think about this year's E3 where they show the 3DS, all they really said about it is it shows 3D without glasses. The goals are so much lower now.
They also kind of said glasses suck. Beyond that, I mean.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't say we're going to put gaming into people's hands who've never played games before. You know, we're going to give you kinds of games that have never been possible before. The 3DS pitch was basically, look, it has pretty graphics and they're in 3D. I mean, it's just so completely different tone.
Please enjoy the 3D visuals.
The fact that it is, of course, you know, it is the 3DS, it's building on that brand, you know, I mean, that I think, you know, that they feel that they've achieved this step change in the market with DS. And,
well, see,
I think
that's why anybody thought, well, they're not going to run with the name 3DS, was deceiving themselves, because... why in God's name would they
Although,
not keep
another,
that moniker?
Although, here's a weird note to close on, rewatching that press conference. Reggie actually explicitly says it will launch with a new name. And of course it didn't.
Oh, weird.
All right, so let's bring an end to this retrospective feature now. I think obviously it's a topic of immense scope that can't be fully covered, especially the DSi stuff and all that we kind of passed on, but... I think it was a worthy topic for this big occasion of 200.
Yeah, I hope our listeners think so. If not before the segment, then after. It is one of those systems that I think I'm going to have around and I'm going to play DS, or at least play DS games when I'm old and gray.
Yeah.
I mean, it was so many classics on it, but also kind of, I would credit it with somewhat re-energizing my interest in the, you know, the whole scene, really. I mean, mm-hmm. Obviously, I never stopped playing Nintendo games, but I certainly started playing them a hell of a lot more once the DS got rolling. And, you know, so I probably wouldn't be here for my, you know, whatever it is now, 120 odd episodes. If it wasn't for the DS.
So to finish this show off, we're going to take care of a little business here. First off, the whole drunk cast contest thing. We were a little disappointed with the level of participation. And so what we've decided to do is instead of play the clip on the show, we are going to email the clip to the people who actually entered before the deadline. And they will get to hear it, and the rest of you... will not.
Failure.
There was a late surge of effort. There was some really, you know, impressive, creative, effort-laden entries towards the end, but I'm afraid in terms of quantity, it didn't meet the threshold. I wanted to do it. I did. But...
Yeah. you know, what we can infer from that is that most of you don't want to hear it, and so most of you will not hear it.
And, take that.
The ones who entered will get the MP3.
And we, as we receive some really late entries, we're still going to have to deliberate over who is going to win the grand prize.
We received some today, if I recall correctly.
Exactly. Well, yes. I think the majority of them we have to receive today.
And some of them are quite lengthy.
So we'll decide on who receives that autographed King of Clubs at some point.
You're all waiting for that cancer to be sent to you.
Waiting with bated breath to not save.
That's right. Remember, you have to tell it you want to save before you load the game, or you can't.
All right. Also want to mention the retroactive poll is still going, and by the time this episode goes up, you'll have until Thursday to vote for your choice on which Game Boy Advance game we will play together and talk about on an upcoming episode of the show. So if you haven't voted yet, please get over there. I can tell you that it is a close race, and so every vote matters. Of course, we did solicit some DS stories, some kind of anecdotes from the listeners about their Nintendo DS experiences and memories. We didn't use any of those on this episode. We didn't get a whole lot of them yet, but
again, bit late comers.
Again,
Johnny come latelys.
People waiting until the last minute. So we figured, you know, let's just hold them off until next week. So if you if any of your memory was jogged by our lengthy discussion on this episode of the whole DS phenomenon. Or if you have any comments on the discussion, if you have anything you want to add, any topics that we didn't get to that you'd be interested to hear about, you can send all of those to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and we'll get to them next time or the time after that. Yes, anything you want, rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Finally, before we go, being at that this is an anniversary episode, I do want to take the time to do something I should do a lot more often, and that's thank all the people who make this show possible. Of course, the staff at NintendoWorldReport.com, which hosts the show and keeps it going and gives us a place to get the word out. To all the listeners who interact with us all the time, send us all kinds of great questions and funny comments and links to stupid videos and everything else. We really appreciate it, and you're the reason that we do this. To everybody who promotes the site, tells their friends about it, you know, writes a review on iTunes, that means a lot, and I appreciate it. You know, everybody who posts and talk back every week and tells us how much fun they had listening to it or how much they laughed at this or that stupid comment that we made. It helps a lot. It really does, and I appreciate it. Of course, I want to thank these guys who are here almost every week and give up a lot of their personal time to do this and, you know, stay up late on Thursday nights and talk to the wall while other people look on in terror. It's a strange hobby that we have. But, of course, extra special thanks to Greg, who spends an obscene amount of time on the show every weekend and makes it sound like we actually kind of know and like each other.
A lot of work. It's a lot of work to make sound, James Lloyd said anything.
It's not true. I've definitively proven there are things I like.
Taking candy from babies.
look, it's
kicking puppies.
Being a sociopathic tropical dictator, he likes quite a bit.
Pushing grandmothers into traffic.
There's one or two ways that you're going to meet your demise, James. You're either going to be shot by a child like Mr. Burns, or you're going to be assassinated with an exploded cigar.
Look, either way, I'm going to get on CNN for it, and then they're going to have me in state at a cathedral. It's fine.
And then they're going to pour over all these podcast episodes to try to find out who the real James Jones was.
It's actually great forensic evidence.
He seemed like a normal graduate, but his obsession with hot tubs prefaced his lust for power.
On Dateline NBC. Miami Nights.
Now in the Situation Room, Blitzer.
I only took 107 dips in the hot tub to buy that yacht. It was fine.
Oh, God.
That should have been the prize. Why are we sending somebody King of Clubs? That game causes cancer. We should at least send Miami Nights. At least that's ironically funny.
This would be the only time this phrase ever uttered. For that purpose, Miami Nights, too good.
Yep.
Oh, God.
So, of course, I want to thank Mike and Evan for founding the podcast 4 years ago. And thank them and hope to have them back on the show sooner or later. And, of course, Carl and Stan, who usurped it and brought it into something. They're really the bridge title between the original RFN and what we do now. So a lot of innovation in the Carl and Stan days.
Is that what we call it now?
Yeah.
Is that code?
They did a lot to make the show what it is today. So I definitely want to thank them. Of course, Jason Ricci for providing the music that we've been using for a long time now. I should mention Jason more, and every time I do mention him, I mention that I should mention him more, because I should.
He's
one of the most amazing musicians on the planet, and very generous for letting us use his music at no cost. I appreciate it. So, did I get everybody?
This isn't a person. This is a group. I'd say that everybody who came to PAX East to see us there is probably a good one to go with.
Man, yeah. That was
absolutely
so awesome.
That was really cool.
All right. I hope you all enjoyed it. And we'll be back next week with yet another one. So here's to RFN 300. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
It's the podcast, people.
There it is. There's the that's the quote. That's the quote for the ages.
A DS game from each of us. It's a sign of things to come. When we come back from the break, we're going to talk about the entire history of Nintendo DS. Well, maybe not the entire, but we'll cover the highlights.
A whole lot of it.
We're just going to do the first 3 months of the DS's life.
We're just going to talk about Ping Pals.
We're actually going to do the entire segment in Ping Pals.
Unfortunately, that clarification isn't going to go well with when I want to bring the music in to start the break, so...
Oh, that's all gone?
What clarification?
The bit where it's like the entire history... Well, not the actual entire history. That's not happening.
It'll
go straight to the music.
Oh, we
fucked
it.
Sorry, Nuance. Fuck off.
Bring in the sledgehammer. Well, I'm sure Zero just developed a hardcore following, and they realized that they could reuse the same assets and spend no money on every successive game.
Yeah, basically, the only effort they did was they collected the concept art they had originally released to the press and slapped it on the bottom screen and called it a day. I mean, it is the least use of the bottom screen of any game ever. It would be more effective if the bottom screen were just turned off, because it wouldn't drain the battery so quickly.
Please enjoy the 2D visuals.
Exactly.
That's Reggie going off at the mouth. Just what, like, well, now it's a 3DS. It'll launch next year. Not so fast, Reggie.
It's like, not so fast. I mean, you're right, but not so fast.
You're going off script.
Or he's telling Iwata via that an announcement that it will not launch this year.
It's an ultimatum.
Yeah. Like, I love the audacity of Jimmy Fallon, where he's like, when's this coming out? And he's so innocent that Reggie actually says next year. And I just wish, you know, I wish the whole thing was an act and Jimmy had followed up with that and he'd been like, so what about DSiWare? Am I going to have to transfer my purchases or something?
Just starts asking really esoteric questions.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Are you going to bring mother over to this?
No, oh my God. Oh my God. That would have been perfect.
No.
Reggie body slams Jimmy Fallon. Throws him through the big screen.
Disaster Day of Crisis, Reggie?
You're one of those Starman, aren't you?